At every step, there was something new. Even if you had success with it, you needed to move forward.
Join me, Clark Peters, as we trace the journey of a true original.
His mother keeps pushing him to go to the violin, and he pushes back.
Legend, the Miles Davis story.
Start Saturday morning at 10:30 on Radio 4 and BBC Sounds.
Good morning, it's 6 o'clock on Monday, the 18th of May. This is Today with Justin Webb in London and Anna Foster in Salford.
The headlines this morning, supporters of the Labour leadership hopeful Andy Burnham have attacked his rival Wes Streeting for saying the UK should rejoin the EU. They argue the focus on Brexit will make it harder for the Greater Manchester Mayor to win the Makerfield by-election. We'll talk later in the programme to a Redwall MP and indeed to the Justice Secretary David Lammy after 8 o'clock. And one other headline, a BBC investigation has found people smugglers in France are telling migrants they can pay for their crossings through a network of UK-registered companies.
Also in today's programme...
The country in general doesn't know which way to turn.
A major new research project is asking people what unites and what divides us as a country.
People don't feel they're a part of a society anymore. Society is generally slowly breaking down, which is really, really sad.
And sticking with that theme of broken communities, Russell T Davis is back with a new series, Tiptoe, about neighbours rubbing along, or not, in Manchester.
This is Leo, my gay neighbour. Oh, that's not offensive.
Well, it is. So watch it.
I used to walk into a room and just go, ta-da! Now I tiptoe, just in case.
Before all of that, the BBC News is read for us this morning by Chris Aldridge.
Allies of the Mayor of Greater Manchester, Andy Burnham, have criticised his Labour leadership rival Wes Streeting for saying that Britain's future lies in the European Union. They suggest the former Health Secretary's intervention was unhelpful because highlighting the issue of Brexit could make it more difficult for Mr Burnham to beat reform in the forthcoming by-election in Makerfield in Greater Manchester. Winning the seat would allow Mr Burnham to challenge Sir Keir Starmer and become Prime Minister. Writing in The Express, the Reform leader Nigel Farage said Andy Burnham wanted to rejoin the EU and that voters in Makerfield deserved honesty. Our political correspondent Joe Pike reports.
Labour's 2024 general election manifesto promised that there would be no return to the single market, the customs union or freedom of movement. If either Andy Burnham or Wes Streeting were to succeed Sir Keir Starmer, the UK would have a Prime Minister who supported rejoining the EU at some point in the future. Over the weekend, both men reaffirmed that position, but Mr Streeting did it far more wholeheartedly. He said in a speech that Brexit was a catastrophic mistake. Allies of Mr Burnham believe that intervention was unhelpful, since it highlights an issue the Greater Manchester Mayor wants to avoid in the by-election. He faces a battle to beat Reform UK in a Leave-supporting area. Yet Mr Burnham said in an interview on Saturday that in the long term there was a case for rejoining the EU, although he wasn't advocating that during this campaign. A spokesperson for Mr Streeting told the BBC that he'd always been a pro-European and the party shouldn't fear debate or ideas.
A BBC investigation has discovered people smugglers in France are saying to migrants that they can pay to cross the Channel illegally through a network of UK-registered companies. An undercover researcher posing as someone trying to make a small boat crossing was told by gang members about British shops and businesses that would accept payment in either cash or as a bank transfer. Josie Hannett reports.
Our undercover researcher made contact with two smugglers in a camp in Dunkirk. Both said payment for a crossing could be taken in the UK. One said money could be sent to the bank account of a car wash in Cambridgeshire or a wholesale business in Newcastle. He also said cash could be paid at a phone shop in London. We secretly filmed workers there agreeing to take nearly £3,000 to pay for two people to cross the Channel. When challenged, those involved later denied smuggling. The Home Office says it's working relentlessly to tackle the networks behind small boat crossings.
And you can watch the documentary The Smuggling Business Undercover on BBC iPlayer now. Figures from the National Crime Agency show the number of arrests for offences linked to people smuggling has gone up by more than 55% in a year. The agency says it was involved in around 300 arrests in the year to April 2026, compared with 190 the year before. It says this follows an increase in the number of officers deployed to focus on organised immigration crime. A review of the HS2 railway set to be published this week is expected to say that political pressure and the original focus on achieving the highest possible speeds were among the reasons for the project's failings and the ballooning costs. In March, the Transport Secretary, Heidi Alexander, asked HS2 bosses to look at lowering the top speed of the trains between London and Birmingham to save money. Here's our transport correspondent, Katie Austin.
The latest review into what's gone wrong by former National Security Advisor Sir Stephen Lovegrove has considered the implications for the civil service and public sector. Its findings are expected to agree with the previous review that HS2's so-called original sins included a focus on the highest possible speeds, changing political priorities, and cost being very badly underestimated. In the coming days, the Transport Secretary is expected to confirm whether HS2 will now cost over £100 billion and that trains won't start running by the latest target date of 2033.
Rwanda says it's tightening screening at its border with the Democratic Republic of Congo because of a deadly outbreak of the Ebola virus. More than 80 people have died from the disease, and experts have warned there's no vaccine, nor is there an effective drug treatment for this strain of Ebola. The government is proposing measures in England and Wales that will make parents and carers more accountable when children offend. It comes after a report last month which concluded that the fatal stabbings in Southport of three young girls in 2024 could have been prevented if the killer's parents had intervened in the years leading up to it. Here's our senior UK correspondent, Seema Kotecha.
The Ministry of Justice says its figures show 8 out of 10 prolific offenders in England and Wales committed their first crime as a child. As part of the proposals, ministers want parents and carers to be made to take more responsibility. They will do this by strengthening and expanding parenting orders. These are issued by the courts and can require guardians to attend counselling or risk a fine. The government is also proposing piloting a new youth court, where judges and justice services work together to tackle the causes of offending.
In golf, Aaron Rye has become the first Englishman in more than a century to win the US PGA Championship. His victory at the Aronimink course in Pennsylvania was sealed when he finished 3 shots clear of his nearest rival. As well as taking home the championship's famous Wanamaker trophy, 31-year-old Rye also receives almost £2.8 million in prize money. Our golf commentator Ian Carter was watching as the Englishman secured the first major title of his career.
Aaron Rye taps it in for a closing par to a brilliant 65 at 9 under par. He has won the US PGA, the first Englishman to do it for 107 years. Another British golfing hero by the name of Aaron Rye.
And that was Ian Carter.
Thank you for that. 7 minutes past 6 is the time. There is talk of a change in the weather. Let's hear what is actually happening. Not talk, but reality from Stavden Ailes. Morning, Stavden.
Morning. Good to you, Justin and Anna. Thank you very much. Yes, indeed. We are looking at a change to the weather finally this week from the unseasonably cold weather we've seen. Last week, temperatures will be on the rise as high pressure builds over the near continent, and that will drop warm southerly winds for many. We could be hitting 26 or 27 degrees in the warmest spots towards southern and eastern parts of the UK, but all areas will be warming up as we head towards the end of the week. Today, though, it's quite a mixed picture. England, Wales and Scotland, it's a day of sunshine and showers, although many places will remain rather cloudy with limited spells of sunshine today. Some of the showers, though, will turn out to be heavy, perhaps thundery with some hail in places into the afternoon. For Northern Ireland, though, stay mostly dry but rather cloudy, and that cloud will thicken up as we go through the day. Wind today will be light south to southwesterly, and temperatures slightly up on yesterday's values. We're looking at 12 to 15 degrees across the northern half of the country, 13 to 16 further south. Now tonight it does turn wet and windy for all as low pressure sweeps across the UK. So some good news there for the farmers and gardeners. It has been a very dry, of course, throughout April and into the very start of May as well. So some useful rain for many. It will be milder overnight, 6 to 11 degrees. Tomorrow early rain clears eastern areas to leave another day of sunshine and showers. We should see a bit more sunshine tomorrow, but some of the showers will be really pokey, heavy with hail and thunder in places. Fresh west-southwesterly winds continuing, but slightly milder still, 13 to 17 Celsius, up to 19 degrees in the southeast.
Thank you, Stav. 6 now. Let's take a look at the morning papers. Politics dominates the Makerfield by-election in which the Mayor of Greater Manchester, Andy Burnham, is likely to stand as Labour's candidate, is on all of the front pages this morning. The Times says that Mr Burnham's allies are accusing Wes Streeting of sabotage. This is after the former Health Secretary's comments this weekend that Britain's future lies in the EU. Quotes, one ally is saying that Mr Streeting's stance is counterproductive to Labour winning at that by-election. They add that Wes's only hope at becoming the next leader is for Andy to lose the by-election. But a source close to Mr Streeting suggests to the paper that his stance is uncontroversial because the Mayor of Greater Manchester had also in the past backed rejoining the EU.
The Telegraph says it understands that Mr Burnham will not campaign on reversing Brexit in his battle for the seat. It quotes a spokesman for him saying it would be focusing, he'd be focusing on local issues, not standing on a national manifesto. The Guardian quotes allies of Mr Burnham describing his race to win the by-election as perilous. The paper says the outcome is likely to determine not only the immediate political future of Keir Starmer, but also the viability of Labour as a whole. And the I paper reports that the Prime Minister has spent the weekend at Chequers considering his future and that he's been in discussion with aides about whether he can revive the government or should announce a timetable for exit.
The Prince of Wales will sell off a fifth of his private estate, the Duchy of Cornwall, in the next decade, according to The Times. The paper says that he plans to invest in housing and nature. The duchy is spread across 21 counties. It's been given to every heir to the throne since the 14th century. The paper reports that Prince William's plans include funding the building of affordable homes on the Isles of Scilly, in Cornwall and in Kennington, in South London, and putting more than £200 million into wildlife projects.
The Guardian tells the story of the 1970 World Cup Panini sticker book, which its owner has finally managed to complete 56 years after he started it. Stephen Butler had left it in his loft, but then going through it, realised it was still missing the sticker for Chile, which hosted the tournament in 1962. The paper says he found one for sale online for £150 and filled the book on the day that FIFA announced it would be ending its partnership with Panini in 2030.
Not sure I've ever seen a fully completed Panini sticker book. It's a rare and special thing. It is 11 minutes past six now. A BBC investigation has discovered that people smugglers in France are instructing migrants to make payment for small boat crossings via a network of UK-registered companies. An undercover BBC researcher was told to leave cash for an illegal crossing at one mobile phone shop in southeast London or transfer money straight into two different UK company bank accounts. One of those was a car wash. The other was a wholesale business. Well, let's talk to our correspondent Josie Hannett about this. Josie, tell us a bit more about your investigation.
So more than 40,000 people made that dangerous journey across the English Channel last year, and it's all facilitated by people smuggling gangs who are based in France. Now, we wanted to learn more about this criminal trade and whether all the work to stamp it out was working. So we sent in an undercover researcher posing as a migrant into the camp in Dunkirk to secretly record the smugglers. Now, within a few minutes, we were face to face with a smuggler called Zia, who explained to us how we could leave money at businesses all over the world, including in the UK, to pay for that crossing.
You can put the money in UK or Afghanistan, as you wish. I'm confident in myself. In London, they don't give you a receipt. They call me to say I have got the money. When you cross, they transfer to me.
So our researcher was also given details for a second smuggler called Ahmad. And when we were back in the UK, our researcher kept in contact with him. Now, he was really pushing our researcher to pay for a small boat crossing, £2,700 for two people. He said we could pay via UK registered companies. Now, he sent us to a mobile phone shop on a street in southeast London, a shop that we've also discovered was recently fined £26,000 for selling illegal vapes. So we sent our undercover researcher in, secretly recording, posing as a relative of a migrant trying to cross the channel illegally from France. The shop quickly explained how these illicit money transfers work. Now, we've translated his words, and interestingly, he even tells us about the risks involved with crossing the channel.
You put your money here. If your people do not cross, if he tells me to return your money back to you, I will do it. You cannot count on boats. You never know. God forbid the boat sink.
So what did they have to say when you confronted them with that evidence?
Well, we tried to contact the first smuggler, Zia, who we met face-to-face in France, but he ignored our repeat requests for comment. Ahmad, the smuggler who sent us to the phone shop in southeast London, he repeatedly denied being involved in people smuggling. And we also went to that shop where he said we could leave cash to pay for an illegal crossing. And the shop worker, face-to-face to us, to me personally, repeatedly denied taking any money for people smugglers, despite that evidence that we'd gathered.
Josie Hannett, thank you. The Home Office has told us it's working relentlessly, it says, with European partners to dismantle the criminal networks behind small boat crossings. The National Crime Agency says it's devoting more resources than ever to tackle people smuggling. You can watch that documentary. It's called The Smuggling Business Undercover. You'll find it on the BBC iPlayer.
6:15 is the time. The United Arab Emirates has reported a drone strike near a nuclear power plant, something the Emirate is calling a dangerous escalation. And separately, Saudi Arabia's defence ministry have said three drones coming from Iraqi airspace were intercepted and destroyed on Sunday morning. Let's talk to Yolande Nell, BBC's Middle East correspondent, who joins us now from Jerusalem. Tell us what you can, Yolande, about what is happening, because both of these nations say they've been attacked. Do they say by whom? Do they say any more about what they did in response?
So in the United Arab Emirates, a drone strike sparked a fire. This was at the edge of the United Arab Emirates' only nuclear power plant yesterday, the Baraka plant. And it's the first time that's been targeted since war began between the US and Israel and Iran at the very end of February. The authorities in the UAE are calling this an unprovoked attack. There are no reported injuries, no reported, importantly, radiological releases. But, you know, they're not specifically blaming anyone. And it's not clear whether it be Iran or these allied Shiite militias, which have also attacked Gulf Arab states. Saudi Arabia is saying that intercepted three drones that came in from Iraqi airspace, as you mentioned. The defence minister there said they would respond at the appropriate time and place. But I think, you know, the choices of targets and the fact that, you know, these countries have been repeatedly hit since the start of the war in Iran, it looks like a message and really a reminder of the risk of any kind of renewed war, as the signs are from both the US and from Iran that they are ready to escalate. They're ready to go back to full-scale fighting once again.
Yeah, Donald Trump's suggesting, in slightly vague terms, it's fair to say, but suggesting that his patience is running out.
Yes. So we know that the US president spoke to the Israeli prime minister by phone yesterday. Afterwards, Donald Trump posted on his Truth Social platform, "For Iran, the clock is ticking and they better get moving fast or there won't be anything left of them." He's not set a new deadline for Iran, but of course, you know, he's repeatedly set those and then backed off. There's this report on the US news site Axios saying that tomorrow Donald Trump will hold a situation room meeting with his top national security advisers about the military options to deal with Iran. That's not been officially confirmed. But in general, it's understood that Israel's coordinating with the US about a possible resumption of attacks. And Benjamin Netanyahu said here to his cabinet yesterday, "Our eyes are open. We're ready for any scenario." And we know that they discussed the main points of the diplomatic efforts between Iran and the US administration.
Yolande Nell in Jerusalem. Thank you.
And oil prices climbing again this morning following that warning from Donald Trump to Iran that the clock is ticking. Felicity Hannah's here with more on that and the rest of the business news as well. Morning, Fliss.
Morning, yes. So prices have been rising in Asian trading this morning. The global benchmark of a barrel of Brent crude currently trading at just over $111. Remember, there's been pressure on oil prices since that war in Iran began. It was closer to $70 a barrel back in February before it all started. Let's talk to Shanti Kellerman, co-chief investment officer at Seven Investment Management. Shanti, good morning.
Good morning.
Donald Trump quite often makes quite fiery statements like this, doesn't he? Last week he declared the truce was on massive life support. How much do his statements directly affect oil prices? And how much is this the market trying to guess what might happen this week, especially in light of those attempted drone attacks in the Middle East we were just hearing about?
I think the rhetoric is having less and less effect because we've seen a lot of it and it doesn't always lead to events. So I think people are more looking at, you know, strikes, what's happening on the ground. You are seeing a little bit more in tankers getting through the strait, but it's still very small. It's gone on long enough that the effort you'll need to go through to get everything back in the right place in terms of refineries started again, ships back in the right places. Even if the strait opened tomorrow, we'd probably have another 3 to 4 months of disruption and higher prices. So I think that's really what the market's pricing in, is we've gotten to a point where it's not an easy fix to get back to business as usual.
Mm. And all this, of course, puts pressure on people, but also governments around the world. Government bonds in this country starting the week hovering around their highest level since the financial crisis. So the yields on 10-year gilts, this is effectively the interest rate charged on long-term government borrowing, is climbing towards 5.2%. And that would be the highest since July 2008. How, Shanti, are investors feeling going into this week?
So I think that rise in yields is two things. One, it's oil and energy prices being higher. And two, it's a bit of the political uncertainty in the UK about what will our spending be in the future? What will the leadership be? The big message is the bond market doesn't believe the Bank of England when it says inflation is going to be 2%. When you have bond yields, you know, 5.5%, 6%, the 30 years at 5.8%. There's a bit of a mismatch there. So I think investors will want to know what's going to happen, but there's no way the UK leadership will be resolved for several months. And it looks like, you know, we'll have a bit more disruption in oil. So I'd expect yields to probably stay higher in the near future.
Is this a problem for the UK government specifically, or are we seeing similar rises in borrowing costs in other countries?
We've seen rises across multiple countries, you know, the US, Europe, but, you know, UK yields are higher than US yields. Some of that reflects inflation and energy costs being higher in the UK than they are in the US. But there's also a lot of countries around the world that have started implementing conservation measures. We haven't gotten there in the UK yet, but it's possible we could do that in the future.
Shanti Kellerman from Seven Investment Management, thank you very much indeed. Now, in November, the government formally announced that it preferred Heathrow Airport Limited's expansion plans for a third runway and new terminal at the airport over rival proposals from the hotel chain Aurora Group. But now the Civil Aviation Authority is considering the possibility of forcing Heathrow to allow external bidders back into the process. Let's talk to Surinder Arora, founder and chairman of Aurora Group. Surinder, good morning.
Good morning.
It looks like Aurora's group's involvement then in the third runway and the terminal project is back on the cards. Does that mean you'll be bidding if there is a new round?
Well, I'll be honest with you. I think there was a lot of misunderstanding that in November when the government chose the scheme, they did not actually choose a promoter. So we've always been there. And we have now revised our plans from last November in line with the government wishes are. And we've come up with the plan in a two-phase runway, working with the airlines, the major airlines, because at the end of the day, who's more expert on what is required is actually the airlines. They're the ones that will be using the runway. So basically, we've done the two-phase runway and get the capacity available sooner within the government timescale, something that is affordable and deliverable and not build initially over the M25.
Okay.
So we've been working with Bechtel and the other consultants, and everyone, including Bechtel and some of the airlines, have had their own independent reports done that the HAL runway proposal cannot be delivered by 2035, which is the government's timescale. The earliest they can deliver is 2040, whereas our scheme, building the runway in two parts, actually gets operationed 2035.
Okay. Just explain, though, please, what it is you'd be bidding to do. You'd be going ahead with a bid for your plan, or would you be asking to be considered to be the contractor to build Heathrow's plan?
No, we want to, you know, we've been saying for last over a decade that Heathrow is the most expensive airport in the world. There's no competition, and the monopoly is really what's causing all the issues. And we're pleased to say that the government and the regulator are now revisiting that and saying there is an issue. We should potentially introduce competition at the airfield at Heathrow. And this is where we're saying that we'll actually build the new runway and the terminal and do it. We're working in conjunction with the airlines on something that is affordable, deliverable, within the government timescale.
I feel like I can almost hear our listeners rolling their eyes over their cornflakes around the idea of a third runway at Heathrow, because it feels like it's been going on forever, doesn't it? This was first backed by the Department for Transport in a white paper more than 20 years ago. Do you think that this government is now going to, is acting with, they say, urgency and pace? Are we going to finally see movement forward?
Well, you know, for the first time, the government actually on this one being very clear, saying we need, as a nation, we need expansion, we need growth, and we fully agree with that. We're all aligned. The only thing is, it can't just be Heathrow. This is where we're saying that we can actually make a difference. And, you know, we've always said from day one, building over the M25 is not easy. It's going to environmental impact, the cost impact, all that. So we've actually come up with a scheme that the phase one of the runway will be ready by and before 2035, and something that the airlines have come forward and supported us on that.
I want to ask you briefly, if you can, we're going into another week of speculation over who should or will lead the government. Do you expect that to have an impact? Could that mean more delays to the bidding process, to the entire project maybe of a third runway?
Well, no, I think everyone, majority of the people, I mean, I think whenever you ask anyone in a room of 10 or 100 in a room, you'll get different opinions, different views. I genuinely believe that the government have now come forward united in a sense that we do need the expansion, we do need the growth, and I really genuinely hope that this is something that'll come forward for the nation that will benefit us all. And, you know, if we can do it within the timescales of the government, if we can do it that works for the airlines and the passengers, that we don't keep on becoming the most expensive in the world, then I think it's a win-win for our nation. Because if we don't, then other countries will, and we'll be left behind, and we don't want to do that.
Surinder Arora, founder and chairman of Arora Group, thank you very much indeed. Now, despite originally being due in autumn last year, the government's defence investment plan is still unpublished, with, as we've just been talking about, the possibility of a fresh battle for number 10 on the way. What might that mean for the UK's defence sector? Let's ask Steve Beddington, CEO of Q5D, which builds military tech and is a supplier to the US Army. Steve, good morning.
Good morning.
You manufacture robots that assemble wire harnesses for drones and vehicles, among other things. So absolutely at the cutting edge of defence technology. The government's defence investment plan is going to outline spending on defence for the next 10 years. How important is it that you get it as soon as possible?
Yeah, both this and the industrial strategy are really quite key. You need to kind of align all the different organs of state together in one direction to make these things work. And that takes time. It's a sort of cultural change as well as an investment. And this potential delay with the change in leadership again is problematic. And we saw this in the last government. Every time there was a change in minister, there would be a change in policy. And these kinds of things have got to last beyond one government if they're going to work properly.
There have been reports of a deadlock, haven't there, between the Treasury and the Cabinet Office over how much money to give to the MOD. Why do you think it's taking so long for the government to come to a decision on that, to publish this plan?
Difficult for me to say outside government. All I can say is that it's important for them to do it. And it's actually partially about money, but it's also about just capability. I mean, part of the reason we are managing to sell in the US and finding it difficult in the UK is the fact that, of course, they do have the ability to do it. But the other one is dealing with a small company is difficult in the UK MOD. They don't really have the mechanisms to be able to do it. There's no route in for companies like us. The bureaucracy and barriers to it are incredibly high. And so, yes, obviously, there does need to be an investment. But secondly, there needs to be a change in the way that they operate, the way that they actually able to deal with small companies like us. Because there's always some level of risk dealing with us. And I think there is a huge risk aversion with us, worry that they might be spending government money in a way that they might be picked up by the media later.
Really briefly, if you can, though, an MOD spokesperson told us since July 2024, they've signed 1,200 major contracts and 93% of that spend has gone to UK-based companies. So they are investing within the UK.
Yes, it's potentially starting to go through. We're kind of one step back. So we are, of course, developing the technology that doesn't build drones and the equipment directly. We make the equipment that automate that manufacture. So, you know, it takes some time for it to flow down to us. Ultimately, we want to be able to sell directly to the MOD, because we believe that if you're building drones, you want to do that on a forward base. You want to do that somewhere you know, in a contested zone.
Okay.
And so it won't, ultimately, we don't think we're going to be selling to the small drone companies that they're investing okay. in company country at the moment.
Mm. Well,
and I
we
think
will...
a lot of that money is going to the larger companies, the major primes, and less of it is flowing down to the smaller companies. That most of that money is coming from venture capital investment.
We will no doubt be covering that defence investment plan when it is released. Steve Beddington, CEO of Q5D, thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you for this. Just coming around to 6:30 now. Time for the sport. Carthy, it's another Monday morning with plenty to talk about.
Yes, one of those very, very busy weekends. And starting with a name that maybe many wouldn't have been thinking we'd been talking about this morning, the English golfer Aaron Rye. He has won golf's PGA Championship for the first time in over a century.
Aaron Rye of England taps it in for a closing par to a brilliant 65 at 9 under par. He has won the US PGA, the first Englishman to do it for 107 years. Another British golfing hero by the name of Aaron Rye, who has romped away from the packed leaderboard to take victory here at Aronimink.
Well, Rye's previous best at a major had been 19th place. This was an unexpected and understated 9-under-par victory for the 31-year-old from Wolverhampton.
There's a lot of incredible and historic English players over those 100 years who have gone on to achieve incredible things and had phenomenal careers. But to win this event and to be a person that's the first one to have won it in such a long time from England is an amazing thing and something to be extremely proud of.
The six-time major champion Rory McIlroy finished in a tie for seventh place. Justin Rose was in joint 10th. And England's Lottie Woad has won the Kroger Queen City Championship. That's her second LPGA Tour title. In rugby union, England are Women's Six Nations champions for the 8th year in a row. They also won the Grand Slam with a 43-28 win over France. Ireland finished in third place in the table, Scotland in fifth and Wales bottom. The former Scotland and British and Irish Lions rugby player Scott Hastings has died at the age of 61. He was part of the last Scotland side to win a Grand Slam in the 1990 Five Nations and is considered one of Scotland's greatest rugby union players. West Ham are 2 points from safety in the Premier League after a 3-1 defeat to Newcastle United. They will be relegated if Tottenham beat Chelsea on Tuesday. Bruno Fernandes equaled the Premier League record for assists in a single season as Manchester United beat Nottingham Forest 3-2, and Sunderland boosted their hopes of playing European football next season with a 3-1 win over Everton. Manchester City beat Chelsea 1-0 to win the FA Cup, their second trophy of this season. Celtic have apologised to Hearts and say they will cooperate with a police investigation into the pitch invasion at the conclusion of Celtic's dramatic 3-1 win over Hearts to win the Scottish Premiership title. All of the weekend's results are on the BBC Sport website. In tennis, Italy's Jannik Sinner has become only the second man after Novak Djokovic to win all 9 Masters 1000 titles, completing the set by winning the Italian Open in Rome.
I think this year was the 50th year since an Italian won, and really, really happy. A lot of tension, you know, on both sides. It was not perfect tennis from both of us, but I'm really, really happy. Incredible last 2.5 months.
And Great Britain's Alfie Hewitt won a third consecutive wheelchair singles title in Rome, beating his doubles partner, Gordon Reid, in the final.
Carthy, thank you. It is time now for more journeys of musical discovery.
The new series of Add to Playlist
on BBC Radio 4. We put together 5 pieces of music to create a totally unique playlist.
He wanted to really emulate the Paris Boulevard, the beeping of the horns, yeah. The chaos in Paris.
And we're joined by 2 studio guests to help us compile the 5-track playlist.
These twists and turns and mood changes, and we go through such an enormous range of emotions.
The new series of Add to Playlist on Radio 4 and BBC Sounds.
With me, Anna Phoebe.
And me, Jeffrey Guacci.
Starts on Friday evening at 7:15.
To listen on your smart speaker, just say Play Radio 4.
It's 27 minutes to 7. You're listening to Today on BBC Radio 4 with Justin Webb in London and Anna Foster in Salford. And Chris Aldridge has a summary of the news.
Allies of the Mayor of Greater Manchester, Andy Burnham, have criticised his Labour leadership rival Wes Streeting for saying that Britain's future lies back in the European Union. They suggest the former Health Secretary's intervention was unhelpful because highlighting the issue of Brexit could make it more difficult for Mr Burnham to beat reform in the forthcoming by-election in Makerfield in Greater Manchester. Winning the seat could allow Mr Burnham to challenge Sir Keir Starmer and become Prime Minister. Writing in The Express, the Reform leader Nigel Farage said Andy Burnham wanted to rejoin the EU and that voters in Makerfield deserved honesty. A BBC investigation has discovered people smugglers in France are saying to migrants that they can pay to cross the Channel illegally through a network of UK-registered companies. An undercover researcher was told by gang members about British shops and businesses that would accept payment in either cash or as a bank transfer. The Home Office says it's working relentlessly to tackle the networks behind small boat crossings. A review into the problems suffered by the HS2 rail scheme linking London and Birmingham will criticise the original focus on the highest possible speeds and how costs were badly underestimated. The findings by the former National Security Advisor Sir Stephen Lovegrove are due to be published this week. Rwanda says it's tightening screening at its border with the Democratic Republic of Congo because of a deadly outbreak of the Ebola virus. More than 80 people have died from the disease. The Dutch cruise ship at the centre of the Hanta virus outbreak is approaching its final destination, the Netherlands port of Rotterdam. The outbreak on board the MV Hondius during a trip from Argentina to Cape Verde has killed 3 people and led to dozens of people being placed into quarantine. When it docks, the remaining crew on board will also be quarantined and the ship will be disinfected.
Thank you for that. 25 to 7 is the time. Britain should rejoin the EU. So says Wes Streeting, who hopes to be the next leader and prime minister. Andy Burnham, the mayor of Greater Manchester, says there is a long-term case but is not advocating it now. He, of course, faces a by-election in Makerfield, assuming he is standing, in which his principal opponents will be Reform. Let us talk to Henry Zeffman, our chief political correspondent, joins us now from Westminster. Quite the argument to be having at this moment, Henry.
Yeah, absolutely, Justin. So as you said, Wes Streeting saying at the weekend Brexit was a catastrophic mistake and that one day the UK should rejoin the EU. That's pretty similar to remarks that Andy Burnham made at Labour's annual conference last year, where he said, "I hope in my lifetime I see this country rejoin the European Union." But yesterday he softened that slightly. He said, in the long term, there is a case for Britain rejoining the European Union. But he said, "I am not advocating that in this by-election." And you have allies of Andy Burnham thinking that this was an unhelpful intervention, perhaps even a deliberately unhelpful intervention from Wes Streeting, given the particular dynamics of the Makerfield constituency where Andy Burnham is the presumptive Labour candidate. Really? I think what this... Sorry, Justin.
So just on that, they're actually suggesting, are they behind the scenes, that Wes Streeting is trying to prevent Andy Burnham from winning?
Well, I think that is... What some, yeah, that, I mean, that is what, yes, in a word, that is what some supporters of Andy Burnham are saying. And I think what all this emphasises is the unusual nature of this by-election campaign, where you have Andy Burnham running to be the MP in Makerfield, but we all know that is the prelude to a contest to be the Labour leader and to be the Prime Minister. And this perhaps is an issue where it's a test run of Andy Burnham trying to set out a local manifesto for Makerfield, trying only where he wants to set out more of what his national manifesto might be. And all the while, you will have Wes Streeting, who resigned as Health Secretary last week, running a national campaign because he is preparing for a Labour leadership election in which he confirmed at the weekend he would be a candidate.
Meanwhile, with Keir Starmer, do we know what his plans are and what he's up to at the moment?
Yeah, I mean, I think that is the most striking thing here. This is a conversation about Britain's place in Europe taking place around the Prime Minister. It's only a week ago today that Sir Keir Starmer gave his fight back speech after the local and national elections, in which Europe was a big part of it, but he didn't go anywhere near as far as wanting the UK to rejoin the European Union. So this is a conversation that has moved fast because of other people in the Labour Party who want to succeed him as leader. And I think this reflects that last week was one where the Prime Minister fought hard to stay in his job and at times looked like he had successfully called his colleagues' bluffs and seen off the threat of an imminent challenge. But it was a week that ended with the prospect of a Labour leadership election within a few weeks or months looking pretty likely. I mean, we will hear from the Prime Minister today in some form and certainly over the course of this week. And Keir Starmer will talk at some point this week about further cost of living support for households dealing with the impact of the war in the Middle East. He hasn't actually taken journalists' questions since a week ago when he was looking in a pretty different position. Worth remembering, though, if there is to be a Labour leadership election, as almost every Labour MP now assumes there will be at some point, So Keir Starmer is automatically a candidate. He doesn't need to solicit nominations. So it may well still be the case that Keir Starmer will be putting his case against Andy Burnham and against Wes Streeting.
Henry Zeppin, thank you.
21 minutes to seven. Rwanda is tightening screening at its border with the Democratic Republic of Congo amid a new deadly outbreak of the Ebola virus. There have been around 80 deaths, or reported deaths at least so far. It could be more than that. The BBC's been told by some people that only Rwandans are being allowed to cross back into Rwanda, not Congolese. And that has heightened fears that the health emergency will affect people's livelihoods as well. Thomas Mukwana is our correspondent in Nairobi. Thomas, as we were saying, the numbers that have been reported so far, we don't know if they've been underreported at this stage, but what do we know?
The WHO actually says that the number could be a lot higher than is being reported. And that's because they suspect that the current outbreak was undetected for weeks, possibly. The first man was diagnosed with Ebola across the border in Uganda around Friday. And the morning of that day on Friday is when we had the Africa CDC declaring an Ebola outbreak in the DRC, making it the 17th. And over that time, the figures on who's been infected, who's suspected to be infected, have stood at 246. And the death toll has climbed to around 90, according to some reports. But there isn't much coming out of DRC, and that's said to be also because of communication lapse between WHO and MSF and all these organizations working in these areas in the Ituri province, which is the epicenter, and WHO.
Which makes containment, Thomas, more difficult. What concerns are there about how far this might have spread already and how far it could potentially spread?
The potential of this becoming a huge catastrophe for East Africa, that can't be overstated, because Ebola, the last time West Africa was hit by the biggest Ebola crisis the world has ever recorded, it took with it around 11,300 people. And DRC is smack in the middle of the African continent. Around it are nine countries, particularly the eastern countries, the countries of Uganda, South Sudan and Tanzania. Uganda's already recorded its first case, as I said, within a day of the Africa CDC's announcement. And within Democratic Republic of Congo, three towns were at the center of this in the Ituri province. And over the past day, we've recorded a case in Goma, according to reports, that a woman who traveled from Ituri province after burying her husband took with her the virus to Goma, which is at the border with Rwanda, which caused Rwanda to then tighten its border controls. Reportedly, also Uganda has tightened its border controls and Kenya has enhanced screening.
Yeah, we'll keep a close eye on it. Thomas, thank you. Thomas Mukwana, there, our correspondent in Nairobi.
18 minutes to seven. The Times is reporting this morning that Prince William is planning to sell off 20% of the Duchy of Cornwall. Let us talk to Barry Caffrey, our reporter, who is here in the studio. Why, Barry? What's the purpose of it?
Yeah, well, the Prince of Wales inherited this estate when his father became king. It's worth more than £1 billion. And the Duchy provides Prince William with a private income of around £23 million a year. This money is used to fund the private and charitable lives of William, as well as the Princess of Wales and their three children. Now, it's understood that Prince William will sell a fifth of the duchy, as he plans to invest £500 million in tackling the housing and nature crises. The Times is reporting this morning that the prince will consolidate his holdings into around five geographic heartlands. So it's going to focus on Cornwall, Dartmoor, the Bath area, the Isles of Scilly and Kennington in South London. Now, we have heard from Will Bax, who is the chief executive of the Duchy of Cornwall. He told the Times that Prince William decided the duchy shouldn't just exist to own land, that it should first and foremost exist to have a positive impact on the world. And now, of the plan to sell off about a fifth of the duchy estate, he said that if we don't see an opportunity for positive impact, then perhaps we don't need to be a part of that place. He said, where there is social need and where there is an environmental challenge and an opportunity to enable change, then we'll be a great partner in working with people to achieve that. Now, Will Bax became chief executive in 2024, and he said Prince William had given him a mandate to tackle climate change, nature decline and the housing crisis on the estate, as well as driving economic growth in struggling communities. Mr. Bax said that the Prince planned to invest the 500 million, as I said. This will be made up from land sales, development income, partnerships and borrowing, and it includes £160 million for housing, such as affordable homes, we are told, on the Isles of Scilly, in Cornwall and in Kennington in South London. And they hope 10,000 to 12,000 homes could be unlocked, they say, between now and the year 2040.
Barry Caffrey, thank you.
Just coming round to 6:45, a major research project aiming to find out what could bring the UK together is asking us to share our views on what unites us and what divides us. The study by Oxford University is being launched today by a cross-party commission that aims to tackle community divisions across Britain. It was set up after the riots in 2024. Our Midlands correspondent Navtej Johal has been to one of the areas that saw protests and counter-protests over immigration last summer.
The sound of division. Last summer, a protest over immigration and a counter-protest laid bare the tensions over the issue in the town of Newark in Nottinghamshire, mirroring the disagreements felt around the country. Well, almost a year on from those protests over immigration, here in Newark you don't need to travel far around the marketplace to find people for whom that remains a big topic of debate and division.
I'm Ian Baines, I'm 66 and I'm a salesman.
What do you think are the issues, the things that are dividing us right now?
Well, to be honest with you, I think that the country in general doesn't know which way to turn.
Is there an issue within politics at the moment that you think is divisive?
Well, I think the biggest issue at the moment is the immigration problem, which doesn't seem to be getting sorted. How to stop the boats and smash the gangs. But obviously nothing's happened, nothing's been getting there, and people feel let down.
Ian, do you think there's still anything as a country that unites us at the moment?
No. I feel the country's falling apart, to be honest with you. I don't think there's anything that really unites us anymore. You see the crime levels going up, people are fed up with all the crime, people don't feel they're a part of a society anymore. And I think that's through successive governments, really, to be honest with you. I think society is generally slowly breaking down, which is really, really sad.
Since 2001, Newark has been a Conservative seat until earlier this year, when the local MP, the former Immigration Minister Robert Jenrick, defected to Reform. A decade ago, 60% of voters here backed Brexit. According to the most recent census, almost 93% of people in Newark and Sherwood were born in the UK. And the most recently available government data shows that around a third of children in the town live in relative low-income families, higher than the England average of just over 1 in 5.
Can they have pulled pork and beans?
It's not just immigration causing division here. Market traders, maybe more than most, are acutely aware of the impact of the rising cost of living.
Hello, I'm Nav from the BBC. Nice to meet you. How are you?
Hi.
My name's Michael Thorne. I'm the owner of Farm to Fork Family Butchers. I'm an employer who employs 9 people. Not a massive employer, but we employ 9 people. But it's just all the general cost of everything going up. I mean, you know, we have units which we run, we have to employ staff. There's a lot of expenses.
Do you think division in terms of people arguing, disagreeing with each other, rowing with each other, feeling maybe like they don't all have something which is binding them as a community together, do you feel that's got worse over recent years?
Without a shadow of a doubt. And it's not just this town, it's every town.
Let me ask you then, why? Why do you think division has got worse?
Number one is the cost of living crisis. Number two is, I personally feel they're building enough houses, and people who, like, I'm quite fortunate at my age to have been on the housing ladder. My son, who's 29, he's just got on the housing ladder. It's just all the other costs on top to try and go forward, especially younger people, the younger generation. Where can they go forward if there's nothing there for them to go forward to?
Now, just around the corner is a woman who has recently seen the best and the worst of the community in Newark after her shop was broken into twice last month.
Hi, I'm Kat Mayer. I'm 47 and I own a shop in Newark called Tentacles of Time. It's made me more anxious about being around the town centre. And obviously, a lone worker, it's made me up security with alarms and things. And I've got more CCTV footage. I think the day that I arrived to see my shop in an awful state, I had 3 separate shop owners bring me coffee and flowers. which was amazing. I didn't realise I'd had such an impact on the community. I've not even been open a year. I've had customers messaging me, like I said. I've had people just popping in saying, "I'm so glad you're open. How are you? Checking on my welfare." So I feel hugely part of the community now.
There's a big national survey being launched all around trying to find a shared vision for the UK. For you, what sort of country do you want to live in?
You know, I'm a hard-working person that's had my business robbed, yet I'm carrying on, and that's through the support and of everybody else here. So I think it is just everyone, like I said, everyone has their own story and journey to go on, and I think I would just like the respect. We respect each other and allow each other to try and live the best we can, and if we have an issue, then we sort that out amicably.
That was Naftas Johal reporting. It brings us to 11 minutes to 7. We are to get new rules to stop the illegal dumping of waste, including a new prison term of up to 5 years for people found guilty of doing it. Let us talk to Anna Willits, who's environmental criminal defence lawyer and partner at Gunner Cook. Good morning to you.
Good morning. Thank you for having me on this morning.
Well, thank you for coming on. The idea behind this presumably is one you approve of.
Yes, I definitely agree with improving mechanisms to deal with waste crime. But I have to say, I'm a little bit cynical about the trumpeting of how good these mechanisms will be and how actually they will work.
What do you think it is that the government haven't then got right?
It's not so much they haven't got it right. It's that I don't think it goes far enough. And I think this is tinkering around the edges. The new prison sentence for dealing with this, that there's already in law, in legislation, environmental legislation, capacity for up to 5 years in prison for these kind of offences. So I'm not quite clear why this is new and why it's different.
Really, that's interesting, because actually one of the things the government is briefing is that that's not the case, that there aren't custodial sentences at the moment for this crime, and there are going to be in the future. You're saying that's not quite right.
Yeah, the Environmental Protection Act already has capacity for that under Section 34, knowingly permitting, knowingly causing. The wording isn't specifically for waste carriers, which is what you're talking about, so carrying waste, but it's to do with depositing waste. And by carrying waste, you will end up depositing it or causing it to be deposited. So that capacity is already there. Mm. There are also other sentences for unlimited fines and custodial for lots of other extraneous environmental offences which lead to this. My issue that I've seen in courts is those sentences not being enforced because the information isn't given to the courts and the judges for them to properly be able to hand those sentences down. So we can have as many prison sentences as we want, but my issue is if they're not enforced and they're not used properly and you don't catch them, then
the government's desperately trying to get people out of prison, isn't it? So all these things sound a bit hollow, don't they? And you don't think it's going to amount to anyone going to prison for a longer period than they could at the moment. Yeah.
For me, the issue is prevention is better than cure.
Okay, so I want to bring up bovine. Bovine is a cow owned yes. by Anne Maidment. You'll know all about bovine. Anne Maidment is the director of the Country Land and Business Association. So she applied for a licence for bovine to take part in these activities, a licence to be able to dump waste legally, handle waste legally, and bovine was given the licence. Now, are you satisfied that under the new rules that could not happen?
It does appear from what I've read that the rules will make things more difficult for that to happen, such as background checks. In the past, some of these registrations, it's not, the wording is not quite right. They're not actually been applied for. You don't apply for these kind of permits that you're talking about, these licences. You register them, so you go on a computer and within 2 minutes it is registered, no human being checks it. And this happened 10 years ago with, it's happily known in the industry, race industry, as Oscar the Dead Dog. Somebody did a similar thing, and it was 10 years ago that's happened, and it's taken 10 years for this to change. So I'm hopeful on this and positive that these new mechanisms will improve this side of things, yes.
Because it is an awful business, isn't it? I mean, for people who have to live next to these sites, and there are quite a few of them, we've talked about them on the programme before, you sound semi-hopeful that life might get a bit better for them.
Yeah, and as I said earlier, prevention is better than cure. Prison sentences and enforcement is all the far end of it. Stopping these sites in the first place is, for me, and a lot of my colleagues in the waste industry, is far better than trying to catch people and put them in prison 5 years down the line after they've done it. We want the environment to be protected. We don't want pollution. And for example, when the BBC uncovered the 11 super sites earlier this year, one of them has been reported to the Environment Agency for 7 years. So, great, yeah. Catch the man, put them in prison, but wouldn't it have been better to have shut the sites down before they got any bigger?
Anna Willits, thank you very much.
It's 6 minutes to seven. An alleged Iraqi commander of an Iranian militant group has been arrested by US authorities, who believe that he is linked to 18 different terror attacks across the UK, Europe and Canada. Jason Burke is with us, international security correspondent at The Guardian. Morning, Jason.
Morning.
What do we know about him?
In terms of his actual life, biography, we don't know an awful lot. We know he's 32, he's Iraqi, he is a senior operational commander in a militia called Kataib Hezbollah, which has been around for about 20 years, but and has always had very close relations with Iranian security establishment, if you like, particularly the Islamic Revolutionary Guard Corps, and has been used to effect proxy attacks in the region and now we think further afield by Tehran.
The further afield bit is particularly interesting. As you say, Iranian militia groups are quite pervasive inside Iraq, but tell us more about some of these attacks that he's thought to be linked with, masterminding.
Well, the FBI have picked him up basically on the basis that he was planning attacks in the US. That's what they've got from interceptions of communications, but also conversations he had with an undercover FBI agent. I think what's really of interest to observers and analysts and security officials, particularly in Europe, is his connection to the 18 attacks in Western Europe, in Belgium, France, Norway, elsewhere, and also, importantly, in the UK over the last couple of months. I mean, we've seen this wave of apparent terrorist attacks in the UK. We had the stabbing of two Jewish men in Golders Green last month. We've had attacks on Jewish charities, range of other attacks that have caused huge consternation. And at the time, it was widely suspected in the intelligence community and beyond that these were acts linked to Iran. But the exact mechanics of that, the mechanisms by which Iranian secret services were managing to orchestrate this, were unclear. And what's really interesting about the detention of al-Sadi is that we can see for the first time the operations, as it were, in real time of the Iranians in trying to prosecute what looks like a long-distance campaign of low-level terrorist attacks across Europe.
Mm. And does that appear to be increasing?
Well, the Iranians have been doing this sort of thing for quite a long time. It's always been part of their strategic arsenal, if you like. And it goes right back to the early 80s and the days after the immediate aftermath of the Iranian Revolution of 79. But beyond that, it has been increasing recently, partly because it's been increasing in the last couple of months because we've had a war against Iran. And this most recent campaign is clearly part of that broader conflict. But it's been increasing over years. One of the key factors is that it's just easier to do this sort of thing now. I mean, once you used to have to either send or recruit quite highly trained intelligence operatives, these days you can recruit someone online, give them a few hundred euros and off they go.
It becomes far simpler. Yeah,
exactly.
Really appreciate it. Thanks for your analysis this morning. Jason Burke, international security correspondent at The Guardian.
The 8th of August, 1963. A gang of thieves hold up a British Royal Mail train on its way from Glasgow to London. More than £2 million was stolen, and Ronnie Biggs was the most famous face of the great train robbery.
Daniel Mays reveals the true story of Ronnie Biggs.
A train robbery, a prison escape, and 36 years on the run.
Gangster presents The Story of Ronnie Biggs.
Listen first on BBC Sounds.
Let's check the weather. Here's Dav Danaos.
Thanks very much, Anna and Justin. Good morning to you. Well, after the unseasonably cold weather that we've had for the past week, this week sees the temperatures rising as we head towards the end of the week. Certainly as high pressure over the near continent builds in and brings us southerly winds with increasing humidity and increasing sunshine. We could be hitting the mid to high 20s in Celsius by the time we hit Friday. First half of this week, though, looks rather unsettled. We've still got low pressure in the mix. That's going to bring showery rain and, for a time, stronger winds too. Now, today looks quite mixed. Although we're starting off, plenty of sunshine. That's the northern highlands and the eastern half of England. Showers have got going from the word go across the rest of England and Wales. Some heavy ones around. They'll continue to become more widespread as we head through the afternoon across England, Wales and Scotland. Some heavy with hail and thunder and a little bit of sunshine in between, but rather cloudy. Northern Ireland, apart from the odd shower, it is mostly dry and cloudy for you. That cloud will continue to thicken up as we head through the day. Temperatures today up on Sunday's values, with 12 to 15 degrees for the northern half of the country, 13 to 16 in the south. And winds will generally remain light from the south to southwest. That's your weather.
Staff, thank you for that. You are listening to Today on Radio 4 with Anna Foster and Justin Webb.
Good morning. It's 7 o'clock on Monday, the 18th of May. The headlines today: supporters of the Labour leadership hopeful Andy Burnham have criticised his rival Wes Streeting for his pro-EU remarks, suggesting they could undermine the campaign by the Greater Manchester mayor to win the Makerfield by-election. A BBC investigation has found that people smugglers in France are telling migrants they can pay for their crossings through some UK-based companies. And the golfer Aaron Rye has become the first Englishman to win the US PGA Championship in more than a century.
Coming up in the next hour:
the country in general doesn't know which way to turn.
A major new research project is asking people what unites and what divides us as a country.
People don't feel they're a part of a society anymore. Society is generally slowly breaking down, which is really, really sad.
We'll hear about that from the former Home Secretary, Sajid Javid, and also the playwright, James Graham. And we'll cast an eye over an exceptional collection of nearly 800 tartans that have been gifted to the museums of Scotland. The BBC News is read this morning by Chris Aldridge.
Allies of the Mayor of Greater Manchester, Andy Burnham, have criticised his Labour leadership rival, Wes Streeting, for saying that Britain's future lies in the European Union. They suggest the former Health Secretary's intervention was unhelpful because highlighting the issue of Brexit could make it more difficult for Mr Burnham to beat Reform in the forthcoming by-election in Makerfield in Greater Manchester. Winning the seat could allow Mr Burnham to challenge Sir Keir Starmer and become Prime Minister. Writing in The Express, the Reform leader Nigel Farage said Andy Burnham wanted to rejoin the EU and that voters in Makerfield deserved honesty. Our political correspondent Joe Pike reports.
Labour's 2024 general election manifesto promised that there would be no return to the single market, the customs union or freedom of movement. If either Andy Burnham or Wes Streeting were to succeed Sir Keir Starmer, the UK would have a Prime Minister who supported rejoining the EU at some point in the future. Over the weekend, both men reaffirmed that position, but Mr Streeting did it far more wholeheartedly. He said in a speech that Brexit was a catastrophic mistake. Allies of Mr Burnham believe that intervention was unhelpful, since it highlights an issue the Greater Manchester Mayor wants to avoid in the by-election. He faces a battle to beat Reform UK in a Leave-supporting area. Yet Mr Burnham said in an interview on Saturday that in the long term there was a case for rejoining the EU, although he wasn't advocating that during this campaign. A spokesperson for Mr Streeting told the BBC that he'd always been a pro-European and the party shouldn't fear debate or ideas.
A BBC investigation has discovered people smugglers in France are saying to migrants that they can pay to cross the Channel illegally through a network of UK-registered companies. An undercover researcher, posing as someone trying to make a small boat crossing, was told by gang members about British shops and businesses that would accept payment in either cash or as a bank transfer. More than 40,000 people crossed the English Channel in small boats last year. Josie Hannett reports.
Our undercover researcher travelled to a migrant camp in Dunkirk where they made contact with two smugglers. Both said payment for a crossing could be taken all over the world, including a car wash in Belgium, a restaurant in France and in the UK. One said money could be sent to the bank account of a car wash in Cambridgeshire or a wholesale business in Newcastle. He also said cash could be paid at a phone shop in South East London. We secretly filmed workers there agreeing to take nearly £3,000 to pay for two people to cross the channel. One told us about the risks involved. When challenged, they all denied wrongdoing or didn't answer our request for comment. The Home Office says it's working relentlessly to tackle the networks behind small boat crossings. The National Crime Agency says there's around 100 active investigations into the top tier of criminals behind the trade.
And you can watch the documentary The Smuggling Business Undercover on BBC iPlayer now. Figures from the National Crime Agency show the number of arrests for offences linked to people smuggling has gone up by more than 55% in a year. The agency says it was involved in around 300 arrests in the year to April 2026, compared with 190 the year before. It says there's been an increase in the number of officers deployed to focus on organised immigration crime. A review of the HS2 railways set to be published this week is expected to say that political pressure and the original focus on achieving the highest possible speeds were among the reasons for the project's failings and the ballooning costs. In March, the Transport Secretary, Heidi Alexander, asked HS2 bosses to look at lowering the top speed of the trains between London and Birmingham to save money. Here's our transport correspondent, Katie Austin.
The latest review into what's gone wrong by former National Security Advisor Sir Stephen Lovegrove has considered the implications for the civil service and public sector. Its findings are expected to agree with the previous review that HS2's so-called original sins included a focus on the highest possible speeds, changing political priorities, and cost being very badly underestimated. In the coming days, the Transport Secretary is expected to confirm whether HS2 will now cost over £100 billion and that trains won't start running by the latest target date of 2033.
President Trump has again threatened Iran, demanding it quickly agrees a peace deal after talks to end the war stalled. Writing on social media, he said they better get moving fast or there won't be anything left of them. The government is proposing measures in England and Wales that would make parents and carers more accountable when children offend. It comes after a report last month which concluded that the fatal stabbings in Southport of three young girls in 2024 could have been prevented if the killer's parents had intervened in the years leading up to it. Here's our senior UK correspondent, Seema Kotecha.
The Ministry of Justice says its figures show 8 out of 10 prolific offenders in England and Wales committed their first crime as a child. As part of the proposals, ministers want parents and carers to be made to take more responsibility. They will do this by strengthening and expanding parenting orders. These are issued by the courts and can require guardians to attend counselling or risk a fine. The government is also proposing piloting a new youth court, where judges and justice services work together to tackle the causes of offending.
Rwanda says it's tightening screening at its border with the Democratic Republic of Congo because of a deadly outbreak of the Ebola virus. More than 80 people have died from the disease, and experts have warned there's no vaccine, nor is there an effective drug treatment for this strain of Ebola. BBC's Africa correspondent Thomas Makwana reports.
Rwanda says it's reinforcing screening for people coming into the country after a confirmed case of Ebola virus in the Congolese city of Goma, which is close to the Rwandan border. Concern has been growing about the spread of the outbreak outside DR Congo after confirmation a man died of the disease in the Ugandan capital, Kampala. So far, those who have died are all believed to have been recently in the epicenter of the outbreak in Ituri province, but experts are warning the virus could spread further in East Africa. Nearby countries like Kenya and Uganda have enhanced screening at ports to contain the spread of the virus.
The Dutch cruise ship at the center of a deadly hantavirus outbreak is approaching its final destination, the Netherlands port of Rotterdam. The outbreak on board the MV Hondius during a trip from Argentina to Cape Verde has so far killed three people and led to dozens of them being placed into quarantine. When it docks, the remaining crew on board will also be quarantined and the ship will be disinfected. In golf, 31-year-old Aaron Rye has become the first Englishman in more than 100 years to win the US PGA Championship. His victory at the Aronimink course in Pennsylvania gives Rye the first major title of his career. Our golf correspondent Ian Carter was there.
Aaron Rye taps it in for a closing par to a brilliant 65 at 9 under par. Another British golfing hero by the name of Aaron Rye. England's first USPGA winner in more than a century did it in style to break the Aronimink logjam. It was an improbable outcome given the unique nature of this major, but maybe there was a clue in the name of the venue. Rye statistically had a 1% chance of winning during the front nine, but his eagle at the ninth lit the touch paper. While the rest toiled, the understated Midlander cruised to four back nine birdies, including a near 70-footer on the penultimate hole, reaching 9 under par and ultimately a three-shot win that was as emphatic as it was unexpected.
And that was our golf correspondent Ian Carter.
Chris, thank you. 7:09 is the time. There is to be tougher accountability for parents when children commit offences. That is what the government is telling us this morning. The plans involve parents being forced to take part in counselling sessions with their children or risk being fined or even potentially sent to prison. The Ministry of Justice says that 8 out of 10 prolific offenders committed their first offence when they were a child. Let us talk to Jess Mullen, who is Chief Executive from the Alliance for Youth Justice, which is an organisation that advocates for children to, as they put it, drive positive change in youth justice in England and Wales. Good morning to you.
Good morning.
What do you make of these plans?
I mean, on the parenting orders, I think we feel that parents and families absolutely play a vital role in supporting children to move away from the youth justice system. Our feeling, though, is that the decline we've seen in the use of parenting orders is for a large part because practitioners find that actually engaging with parents on a voluntary rather than mandatory basis is more effective.
Right. So just to focus on that for a moment. So these parenting orders that the government seems to be saying we should use much more often already exist and haven't been used that often in recent years. Is that right?
That is correct. And that is because practitioners find that engaging with parents voluntarily, building trusting relationships with parents and working to support them to then in turn support their children tends to be far more effective. I think the children who are in contact with the youth justice system are extremely vulnerable and experience a wide range of issues from, you know, poor access to children and adolescent mental health services, the challenges in the special educational needs services, the long-standing effects of austerity, the cost of living crisis, and all of these things also impact their families. So those parents need support to be able to provide support to their children. So parental responsibility is absolutely important, but there is also a wider question of societal responsibility and how we all and services wrap around that child and that family.
And presumably the sort of family that you're describing there are either threatening to put the parents in prison or indeed putting them in prison is not likely to help.
Absolutely. That I think that's the concern is how does that provide stability and support to the child by making their family even more unstable.
And yet people look at the case of Axel Rudi-Cabana and other cases as well and say, we are not doing what we need to do at the moment. And that's the point, isn't it, that the Ministry of Justice make with that stat about the number of people who are persistent offenders who actually committed their first offence while a child. In other words, something needs to happen that isn't happening at the moment.
Absolutely. The youth justice system definitely requires reform, and the Lord Chancellor is absolutely right to talk about the need for once-in-a-generation reforms to it. And, you know, in the case of what needs to change at the early end of the system, you know, there's something about that multi-agency working and how do we make sure children and their families aren't falling through the cracks and are getting the support we need so that we stop children actually entering the system in the first place, and the system acts as a sort of repellent shield to push children away from
I just wonder if some people might say we're talking too much about systems. I mean, it is an individual responsibility of you as a parent, isn't it, to look after your child. It is, I mean, to some people, I think it would be really, in a sense, as simple as that. And again, you look at Axel Rudi-Cabana and the criticism that there's been, and indeed was at the initial response of the report about those parents, that actually parents do have a responsibility as individuals that is separate from the system.
They most certainly do. But I think what we see when we look at the children who come into contact with the youth justice system is we see really complex needs and deep vulnerability. And we do have services within our society that are meant to be there to support those needs. And what we actually see is quite often the children who come into contact with the system, that those needs are unmet and those services have failed. And I think
is that a result of resourcing or what?
I think it's a result of long-standing resourcing issues. It's a case of the need for better join-up and better wrapping around that child. And so it's both resources and about how we make sure our services are meshed together so that children don't fall through the cracks.
OK, and we'll be talking to the Secretary of State for Justice and indeed Deputy Prime Minister David Lammy at 8:10. Plenty else, of course, we'll also be mentioning with him, but we will certainly get to this. Thank you very much to Jess Mullett from the Alliance for Youth Justice.
It's 14 minutes past seven. The continuing blockage of the Strait of Hormuz by Iran is having a huge impact on the world economy. But there's also a more fundamental warning that tens of millions of people could face hunger and starvation if shipping doesn't resume. As well as oil and gas, more than a third of the world's fertilizer passes through the strait. And without it, not enough food can be grown to supply everybody who needs it. Well, let's speak to Carl Scow, who's acting executive director of the World Food Programme. Good morning.
Good morning.
Just talk us through the detail of this, how that blocked shipping lane can, through a process, result in the potential starvation of millions of people.
Well, they're really at two levels. The first level is the fact that it's impacting our operations across the world, whether in Afghanistan or in Sudan or in Somalia, for two reasons. One, it's driving up costs, and we were already in a situation where we don't have enough money to do the work that we need to do. And now, of course, we are spending even more on ourselves and hence less on the people we serve. The second is that, like any other business, we have a real challenge around supply chain. So even though you're not bringing something out of the Strait of Hormuz, the other supply chains have been disrupted. And so it takes 3-4 weeks longer to bring rice from India to Somalia, for example. And then the second level, which is maybe the most concerning, is that there is such close correlation between energy costs and food prices. So in countries where energy costs have gone up 30-40%, food prices have gone up 30-40%. And in the poorest countries, people are already spending everything they have on food. And so as a result, they're eating much less. And we expect that by July, If one barrel of oil remains over $100 by July, 45 more million more people will be thrown into acute hunger.
And talk me through some of the detail that you've seen. You've been to Sudan recently, you've been to Lebanon recently, and the number of people facing food insecurity in both places is growing.
I mean, Lebanon is really the epicenter of the humanitarian impact of this war in the Middle East. You know, over a million people displaced. Really disruptive, and the conflict continues despite the fact that there is on paper a ceasefire. And so that is where we are stepping up, serving hundreds of thousands of people either with ready-to-eat meat or ready-to-eat food or with food commodities or with cash. But then, of course, the ripple effect goes far beyond that. I was just in Afghanistan, for example, which is a country that has been hit hard. It neighbors Iran, but it's also had a conflict with Pakistan, the other neighbor on the other side. And over the past few months, it's gone through floods, earthquake, and of course, an economic meltdown due to economic mismanagement. And in a place like Afghanistan, we've also seen deep aid cuts. You know, I was at this clinic that is meant to serve women and children who are malnourished. We have really a malnutrition crisis in Afghanistan, but there is no commodities at that clinic. So hundreds of women standing in queues with children on their arms, severely malnourished, turned away after having walked 3-4 hours to get there with nothing. And you can just, the desperation in the air there, those voices of those women, you know, will stay with me for a very long time.
Let's talk about those aid cuts. As you say, what's happening in the Strait of Hormuz is important. But in your own words a few minutes ago, you don't have enough money. And I noted last week that in Syria, your food aid is being cut quite dramatically. I know you're meeting the Foreign Secretary later, Yvette Cooper. When we say aid cuts, we're talking about countries like the UK, countries like the US, taking money essentially out of international development, in the UK's case, to put it into defence. So what will you be saying to her later?
Well, yes, we have seen a cut across the board. So last year we had a cut 40% year on year. We had to let go of 5,000 people. We cut millions of people of our assistance. And I think it's important to put this in perspective. You know, our budget is peanuts if you compare it to defense budgets, for example. I mean, there are reports that the war in the Middle East costs more than $2 billion per day. Well, our full ask to serve 120 million people is $13 billion. So in less than a week of this war, you would basically fight hunger across the world for the next year. So,
do you feel that the politicians are listening to that message?
Not enough. I mean, for us, it's the humanitarian imperative that no child should go to bed hungry. Children should not be dying of hunger. That should be the driving force. But of course, also, there is an element of self-interest, stability in this. Hungry people have basically three options. They die. They get involved in revolts or violence, or they migrate. And so, there is also an element of self-interest here. I hope in my engagements with the government today that they will also see the need to step up on the aid front. I mean, you mentioned Syria. It's a clear-cut case where unless we step in now, this political and security process will be very fragile. People in Aleppo has not felt the change of this political change. And unless they do tangibly, the support for this political process will not continue. And so there is also a prevention element here. We cannot do with more wars, that's for sure. And unless we invest now, I think we're going to see more instability.
Carl Scow, Acting Executive Director of the World Food Programme. Thank you.
Thank you.
It is 20 past seven. The budget airline Ryanair has reported a rise in revenue for the last year, but warned as well about the ongoing economic uncertainty caused by the closure of the Strait of Hormuz. Fliss is back with the latest. Hello again, Fliss.
Hello, yes. So Ryanair, of course, is Europe's biggest airline, and these are its full year results up to March. It says revenues are up 11% year on year to 15.5 billion euros, or around 13.5 billion pounds. But as you say, Chief Executive Michael O'Leary says global jet fuel prices have spiked and are expected to stay elevated for some months. Let's talk to Charles Hall, Head of Research at the investment bank Peel Hunt. Charles, good morning. Good numbers for Ryanair. Profit after tax was 2.26 billion euros, so up 40%. Not yet reflecting what we're seeing with the conflict, though.
Morning, Fliss. Yes, that's right. They've hedged 80% of their fuel at $67 for full year 27. So they're pretty well covered. So that's a real help in terms of managing their cost this year. What they have said that so far their pricing is down mid-single digit in Q1 and is expected to be flat in Q2. So with the pricing side being difficult to see in the short term, now there's definitely less confidence in the market and people are booking later. Mm. And so they're not giving a profit forecast for this year.
That's quite interesting, actually, isn't it? Because the International Air Transport Association had already warned that airlines cannot continue absorbing the cost of rising jet fuel prices, that they would need to pass those on to consumers. Ryanair, though, these results talks about softening consumer demand and, as you say, flat fares.
That's absolutely right. So these two factors play off against each other. And one of the things that Ryanair always focuses on is its load factor. And that runs at 94%. That's why it's able to be very profitable and have very low fares. And they tend to focus on pricing first and driving that load factor rather than trying to pass on fuel price increases.
And when you say load factor, you mean bottoms on seats?
Absolutely right.
To put it slightly more crudely. Briefly, if you can, these results do also reveal that Michael O'Leary is currently negotiating an extension of his employment contract until April 2032, so beyond the current end of 2028. It sounds like the board want to keep him.
Absolutely. And obviously, he's a great asset. He's been a key driving force within this business. And he's a great publicist as well. You know, he likes picking a fight. And that really emphasizes that he's trying to keep prices down, always talking about countries that are raising airline duty and also regional airports that are putting up their prices. So he's really focused on keeping those prices down. And that definitely helps on getting a lot of free publicity.
Charles Hall from investment bank Peel Hunt. Thank you.
Thank you, Fliss. 22 minutes past seven now. Nearly 800 tartan patterns. It's the whole archive of a company that started creating them back in the 1820s, even clothed Queen Victoria. This whole thing has been gifted to the National Museum Scotland. And as well as being beautiful, the breadth of the samples could also change what we know about the history and development of tartan. Hazel Smith is Director of International Tartans. Hazel, good morning.
Good morning. Thanks for having me on this morning.
Thank you for talking. What a fabulous job title as well. And just tell us, I mean, I think it's always worth having a bit of a lesson about why we have so many different tartans and what they mean.
Well, in fact, I think at the last count, the ones that are registered on the Scottish Tartan Register, I think we have about 14,500. I mean, in the last 20 or 30 years, that the design of tartans, and we design tartans, has kind of exploded. And, you know, often it's charities, often it's corporate organisations, sometimes it's events, Commonwealth Games being one, World Cups being another, recent tartans that have been designed. And sometimes, so charities, corporate events, and corporate and companies, and individuals and families want to design tartans because everybody wants a sense of identity, of place, of belonging, and tartan does that for people.
Yeah,
and for communities.
Never ending possibilities. And so this archive of almost, as we were saying, almost 800. Where does that sit in the wider narrative of tartans?
Well, I guess the story and the history of tartan is constantly evolving. I mean, we're making history with tartan today, and most of our tartans, the ones that we have that belong to us and that we've designed, are quite modern, and they're nation-state tartans or they're commemorative tartans. So they've been designed in the last 30 to 35 years, or the regional tartans. So I think the donation by J&D Payton, the archive of tartan samples, and I think it's incredible. It'll open up a new window, give people a new lens into the history of tartan and tartan weaving in Scotland.
So can you look at a tartan, Hazel? Because you talked about modern ones and contemporary ones versus the older ones. Can you look at it and date it or place it based on the colours and the patterns?
Well, there are two things. I mean, there are rules for a tartan set. And some of the very, very old ones, they didn't follow the rules. And so I can tell a very ancient tartan. Generally, what I can do, because I'm an Indigenous Scottish and I've been around for forever, so I know enough about Scottish names, if somebody walks into us, we have a big interactive screen that we share with, that people get to play with the Tartan Register and with other archives of tartan that are online. So if somebody comes in and says their name is Campbell and they want to find out, or they want to see their tartan, I know that that's number one on the Tartan Register. If somebody comes in and says they're McDonald, I know that that's going to be an old tartan and that's going to be within the top 10 of the tartans on the register or thereabouts. So yes, I can generally, not always, but I can generally date a tartan. I can generally date a tartan. So I can tell if it's an ancient tartan or if it's a more modern tartan 9 times out of 10.
That's a very impressive skill set, Hazel. And I hope these new ones add well to your collection as well. Thank you for joining us this morning. Hazel Smith, Director of International Tartans at the National Museum Scotland.
27 minutes past seven. To the sport, here's Cathy.
Thank you. It would be a lovely link if a Scottish man had won the USPGA Championship, but it was England's Aaron Rye who has won that title. The 31-year-old from Wolverhampton had never previously finished higher than 19th place in a major, but his name is now etched onto the Wanamaker Trophy after a 3-shot win in Philadelphia. The BBC's golf correspondent Ian Carter has the details.
England's first USPGA winner in more than a century did it in style to break the Aronimink logjam. It was an improbable outcome given the unique nature of this major, but maybe there was a clue in the name of the venue. Rye statistically had a 1% chance of winning during the front nine, but his eagle at the ninth lit the touch paper. While the rest toiled, the understated Midlander cruised to 4 back nine birdies, including a near 70-footer on the penultimate hole, reaching 9 under par and ultimately a 3-shot win that was as emphatic as it was unexpected.
Now, West Ham are 2 points from safety in the Premier League after a 3-1 defeat to Newcastle United. They will be relegated if Tottenham beat Chelsea on Tuesday. All of the weekend's results, including details of Manchester City's FA Cup win, are on the BBC Sport website. Celtic have apologised to Hearts and say they will cooperate with a police investigation into the pitch invasion at the conclusion of Celtic's dramatic 3-1 win over Hearts to win the Scottish Premiership title. We can speak to the BBC Scotland sports news correspondent Chris McLaughlin. Morning.
Good morning.
Those scenes after the match with Celtic fans confronting Hearts players completely overshadowed the results. What repercussions have there been, and could there be a legal change after several incidents across this season?
Yeah, I mean, you're right, Carthy. The sporting football world was watching on with fascination at what was happening in Scottish football in recent weeks. And I think that if they had continued to watch after the final whistle had gone, they may well have been scratching their heads because, as you say, a number of incidents, including Hearts fans and Hearts players being confronted by Celtic fans, and those Hearts players having to leave early from the stadium in their full kit to actually get away from what was happening. And a number of investigations will likely follow from the Scottish Premier Football League, from the Scottish FA. Police Scotland have already launched their own investigation. What the SPFL, Carthy, are pushing for here is for those who invade the pitch, for those who enter the field of play, for that to be a criminal offence. Now, it is in England and England and Wales. It has been since 1991. It is not in Scotland, and the SPFL, who have been holding their head in their hands for some time about this issue, which is happening with alarming regularity, they are now looking for government to step in and help do something about this in Scotland.
And obviously we do need to talk about the football because Hearts had been top of the Scottish Premiership since October. It would have been their first title since 1960. Is it likely they could be challengers or disruptors again next season?
Well, I think with the introduction of Tony Bloom at Hearts, then many think this could just be the beginning for them. When he came in as an investor to Hearts, he told them, or told the fans, that he would break the duopoly here in Scotland within 10 years, I think he said. So he clearly was as good as his word in terms of being a disruptor. He, I think, has got an appetite for this. The fans have got an appetite for this. And I would not be surprised if Hearts are here and challenging in some way, shape or form next season and beyond.
Well, it would be interesting. Chris McLaughlin, thank you very much. Just a couple of other headlines for you. In Rugby Union, England are Women's Six Nations champions for the 8th year in a row. They also won the Grand Slam with a 43-28 win over France. And the former Scotland and British and Irish Lions rugby player Scott Hastings has died at the age of 61. Hastings was part of the last Scotland side to win a Grand Slam and will be celebrating his life and sporting achievements later in the programme.
We certainly will. Thank you, Carthy. This week, here on Radio 4, the series which spells out the stats returns.
Gross costs of net zero could exceed £7.6 trillion.
In the City of London, some 84% of babies now have at least one foreign-born parent.
Smoking kills some 7 million people every year.
What do these statistics really mean?
It doesn't mean what you think it means.
And more importantly, what story are they trying to tell us? I'm Tim Harford. And in More or Less, we dig into those numbers we hear in the news and in our lives.
So it's at that point that the math starts to break down.
And discover what they actually prove. The new series of More or Less, Wednesday mornings at 9 on Radio 4 and BBC Sounds.
Starting today, there's a major new research project asking people what unites and what divides us. We're going to hear about that from the former Home Secretary, Sajid Javid, and the playwright James Graham in just a few moments' time.
You're listening to Today on BBC Radio 4 with Justin Webb in London, Anna Foster in Salford, and at 29 minutes to 8, Chris Aldridge has a summary of the news.
Allies of the Mayor of Greater Manchester, Andy Burnham, have criticised his Labour leadership rival Wes Streeting for saying that Britain's future lies back in the European Union. They suggest the former Health Secretary's intervention was unhelpful because highlighting the issue of Brexit could make it more difficult for Mr Burnham to beat reform in the forthcoming by-election in Makerfield in Greater Manchester. Writing in The Express, the reform leader Nigel Farage said Andy Burnham wanted to rejoin the EU and that voters in Makerfield deserved honesty. A BBC investigation has discovered people smugglers in France are saying to migrants that they can pay to cross the Channel illegally through a network of UK-registered companies. An undercover researcher was told by gang members about British shops and businesses that would accept payment in either cash or as a bank transfer. The Home Office says it's working relentlessly to tackle the networks behind small boat crossings. A review into the problems suffered by the HS2 rail scheme linking London and Birmingham will criticise the original focus on the highest possible speeds and how costs were badly underestimated. The findings by the former National Security Advisor Sir Stephen Lovegrove are due to be published this week. President Trump has again threatened Iran, demanding it quickly agrees a peace deal after talks to end the war stalled. Writing on social media, he said, "They better get moving fast or there won't be anything left of them." The government is proposing measures in England and Wales that would make parents and carers more accountable when children offend. It comes after a report last month which concluded that the fatal stabbings in Southport of three young girls in 2024 could have been prevented if the killer's parents had intervened in the years leading up to it. Rwanda says it's tightening screening at its border with the Democratic Republic of Congo because of a deadly outbreak of the Ebola virus. More than 80 people have died from the disease.
Thank you, Chris. It's 26 minutes to 8 now. If we know more about the detail of what unites and what divides us, would that help to bring us closer together as a country? Well, starting today, a major new research project is gathering that information with a plan to try and solve the problem of increasingly fractured communities. The Independent Commission on Community and Cohesion was set up after the riots in 2024. And some recent research by the British Red Cross has suggested that 3/4 of UK adults believe that Britain is divided as a country. So let's discuss this with its co-chair, of that independent commission, the Conservative former Chancellor Sir Sajid Javid, and James Graham, the playwright who has helped to advise on the design of the national conversation. Morning, both.
Good morning.
Good morning.
Sir Sajid Javid, you've described the UK as being in real peril, and it was only over the weekend that we saw a £4.5 million policing operation needed in London to try and keep competing protests apart and keep people safe, which would, a figure like that would appear to back your assertion up.
Yeah, that's right. And as you said at the start, that our social fabric is fraying. There's plenty of evidence of that. But it's not just the statistics. I think we can all just really feel it and what's going on in the country. And it's not something I think anyone really wants to see. They want to see people coming together. And that's why the commission was set up. But that's also why this major new listening exercise is being launched. Because, you know, I think there's been plenty of times when politicians, and I include myself in this in the past, sort of they tried to come up with the answers. You know, this is what we need more of to unite us. This is what's missing. But what's really missing is actually the wisdom, the collective wisdom of the British people. And that's why the national conversation being launched today, running throughout the summer, is an opportunity to listen to people, millions of them, up and down the country through, first of all, an online survey that just takes a few minutes. But really exciting part of this is at the end of that, there's an opportunity for everyone to leave a 60-second voice note. So obviously in their own words, with their own the emotion, the texture they want to give to their language. And we can take millions of voice notes into account and listen to them. And the reason we can do that, by the way, is because of new technology, especially AI, which will mean that every person that takes part, we will listen to every voice note, every single word, and hopefully learn more from ordinary people about what unites us, what can bring us together again.
And what people say will be vital. I wonder when you look back at your working life as a politician, not to make a sweeping generalisation, but politics has really, and politicians have really contributed to the sense of division in the country, haven't they?
Yes, I don't think you can. Your politicians can say they haven't been part of the problem, and part of it. Look, is the nature of the political system is obviously for politicians to compete, and that's what you want in a healthy democracy, to have different views and points of views. But there are ways to conduct that debate, which I think sometimes as a country we've fallen short of, and that's why I thought it's important this commission was truly independent. It's not part of government. There are political parties that support the work that we're doing. It's myself with John Cruddas, who's a former Labour MP, a bunch of commissioners from all sorts of backgrounds. And that's why we've come together to do this in a truly independent way, away from the Westminster bubble, so to speak, but also to come up with a way to listen to millions of people across the country.
Mm. And James Green, I know this is important to you personally, but also it's a theme that comes up in your work as well, that idea of either large-scale division or unity, but also sometimes just between individuals as well.
Yeah, and the reason why I find this so exciting is because it's thoroughly depressing, first off, that the accelerating collapse of social cohesion is causing such unhappiness and such a crisis of well-being, I think, in ourselves personally and also in our communities. It devastates me, the idea that one of the single biggest crises facing particularly young people is loneliness. And how can that be when we have these devices which are meant to connect us better than ever before? And yet, obviously, as we all know, facing the challenges that is the collapse and the hollowing out of our communities, the collapse of social infrastructure in our towns and our villages, we resort to turning inside ourselves and our relationships often. I've got an image in my head of a lot of family and friends I've heard of whose now emotional connections are often with AI chatbots. And that's not some dystopian future. That is really accelerating. And, you know, human connectivity and a sense of belonging is always going to make us happier, better contributors to society. And when politicians can talk about growth and productivity and how we get that going, and of course that means infrastructure and other political decisions, I think the lack of conversation around just how we revive and revitalize our human social capacity for exchanging ideas and empathy and connections, it just isn't on the table. And that's the depressing bit. My hope is by asking people, what do you want of your communities, by going onto the National Conversation website, by leaving a voice note, that amazing, brilliant, hopeful ideas will come out of that.
Yeah. Part of it as well is that idea of, I mean, we talk about it as a national conversation, but it is sometimes that idea of feeling unheard,
yeah,
and of not feeling listened to that also fosters that division.
Completely. Exactly. I've been thinking a lot about what is a healthy conversation, given all the platforms now that we sometimes share our conversations on don't feel like they're particularly kind, nuanced, healthy. Even the rhythm of how we talk to each other has changed. So I will post and I'll edit that post, and there'll be because it's public, there'll be almost a quite performative element to it rather than vulnerable and trusting and honest. So if we're not able to trust one another when we're talking, then how can we possibly come up with any meaningful dialogue with one another? I'm obviously really biased. I think culture and art has a huge place in this as well. We know that physiologically and mentally and emotionally, we feel stimulated and healthier when we get to access art, entertainment together in communities. But the collapse of live music venues, the complete disappearance 8 times a week of a pub in your local community, leisure centres, social groups, youth groups, these are all deteriorating and collapsing. So my hope, when I leave my voice note in a couple of days' time, I'll be talking about how we can revive our desire, effort and ability to get together again. But maybe that's a bad idea. Maybe someone else will have a better one.
Mm. So, Sadia, what would you be contributing? From the heart, what would you be saying that you think needs to be worked on here, needs to change?
Well, I think that, you know, first of all, in terms of what do I think unites us, is that, I mean, first of all, it's not, I'm just one of the voices that we're taking part in this survey. So we want to hear from millions. But, you know, I was thinking about this just the other day, like, when did I first feel that really sort of patriotic about the country? You know, as people may know, that my parents were immigrants. I was born in the UK. It was actually, I was age 7. It was the time of the late Queen's Silver Jubilee. My mum dressed me in red, blue and white, and sent me off to school. And I, with all the other kids there, I just felt so British and so happy and patriotic. And it was a real national moment that brought the country together. And it's been with me really ever since. And I was lucky enough, decades later, to actually meet the late Queen. And I remember bringing it up with her at the time and saying that how I felt. But we will all have our moments and things that have really made us feel that we're so proud to be British. This is our country and the things that will bring us together. So that's what goes on in my mind. But as James just said, I agree, by the way, with everything he said, including about culture, that it's about listening to people up and down the country. And it's by the way, if I can say the web address, it's thenationalconversation.org.uk. That's where people can come and take part in this.
Thank you both. So Sajid Javid, James Graham. It's worth saying as well, actually, it's such an important topic. Evan Davis is going to be presenting a special season on this, looking at what unites us and what divides us. That will be here on Radio 4 over the summer. It starts at the end of June.
8:18 is the time. We were hearing last week the view that Russia's war in Ukraine has undergone a change. Ukraine now with the upper hand and Russian casualties in Ukraine mounting in a way that is not sustainable. Well, over the weekend, Ukraine attacked targets in Russia, indeed in Moscow itself. And Steve Rosenberg, our Russia editor, has actually been to one of those targets or one of the places where a projectile fell. Steve, good morning to you. Tell us what the people there said to you about what had happened.
Yes, I was chatting to people outside one of these apartment blocks just on the edge of Moscow, and you could see the damage to one of the upper floors, and people were looking, taking photos from down below of the damage, and just chatting to people there. There was sort of a mixture. On the one hand, a sense of weariness and frustration that this war is continuing, and that suddenly, you know, people feel that the front line can pop up in their living rooms in the Moscow area. For so long, Russians sort of, many Russians tried to pretend that the war wasn't actually happening, that it was all something happening on television. It didn't really affect their lives. But that's becoming much harder for people to do now. Some people were sort of saber rattling and blaming the West and blaming Europe and saying, you know, we need to send drones against you in Europe because you're supplying Ukraine with weapons. These weapons are being used to attack us. And I think that the messaging in the state media here is designed to try to make people reach that conclusion. What the authorities do not want is Russians joining the dots and concluding that their lack of safety and security today is the result of Vladimir Putin's decision to launch the full-scale invasion. They want people to blame Europe. They want people to blame Britain or Germany or France over what is happening.
How much does this then go to the door of the Kremlin and indeed to the door of Vladimir Putin himself personally?
Well, I talked about messaging, and you know, one of the aims of the message, the messaging, the propaganda in the media is to distract and prevent the public from blaming Vladimir Putin about this. And if you control the media, as the Kremlin does, you control the messaging. But there are two problems, I think, here for Vladimir Putin. For so many years, his image was based on the public perception of Vladimir Putin as Mr. Security, Mr. Stability, right? The leader who steadied the ship after the crazy 1990s. Well, that sense of security and stability has gone. That's the first problem, I think, for him. The second problem is there is mounting frustration, irritation with so many things at the moment. Not only the war, this fatigue with the war, but the economic situation in Russia in terms of prices, rising utility bills and things like that. And we've talked before about the internet restrictions that the authorities have introduced that have sparked a lot of irritation in the public. All this comes together, I think, to fuel a lot of frustration. It does not mean that people are about to rush onto the streets with placards and say, down with Vladimir Putin. We don't see any of that. However, as we move into the summer, there is this deep sense of fatigue and weariness you detect in the population, and people wondering, you know, where is the country going? When is the war going to end? And is there a vision for the future?
And people also wondering about Vladimir Putin's personal sort of mental state, which, it has to be said, Steve, has been something that people have talked about in the past and never seemed to amount to anything, did it, when it came to his ability to stay in power and desire to stay on power. But there is a renewed resurgence, isn't there, of that talk?
Well, you don't hear talk about that on the streets here. There is a lot of discussion in the West about that, and you know, and to an extent, you could argue that's wishful thinking. To an extent, you know, there was a lot of talk a few weeks ago, wasn't there, about Vladimir Putin sitting in a bunker, not coming out for weeks on end. Well, we haven't seen that recently. He's made quite a few appearances, possibly sparked by those reports in the West. We saw him driving his old school teacher to the Kremlin. She was on a visit to Moscow. We saw him attend a conference and have other sort of meetings. So I think the Kremlin is aware of these kind of reports and rumors and wants to quell them, because Vladimir Putin is all about strength. That's the foundation of his image, and the Russians don't want to kind of weaken that.
Steve Rosenberg in Moscow. Thank you.
It's 13 minutes to 8 now. In just a moment, we'll be looking at the deadly outbreak of Ebola, which has hit the Democratic Republic of Congo, causing concern because it's a strain that doesn't have any vaccine at the moment. It doesn't have any treatment either, and it's been late in being detected. So we'll explore that in just a second. But first, it's time for Thought for the Day. And the speaker this morning is the Right Reverend Dr. David Walker, Bishop of Manchester.
Good morning. It took until 3 minutes before the end of extra time on Friday night for Callum Ceesay to score the goal that sent Salford City to a Wembley final, and had most of us in the capacity crowd leaping in celebration. It could have been over much sooner. TV replays suggested that the two Grimsby goals that made 30 additional minutes necessary were, respectively, handball and offside. But with no VAR in the English League Two playoff semis, both stood. And rightly so, I say, even though I have a season ticket at Salford. For me, the use of VAR presents not just a practical problem, but an example of a theological conundrum. In human activity, there's a point beyond which striving for perfection inhibits our ability to do good. The 20th century writer G.K. Chesterton encapsulated it beautifully when he quipped, "If a job's worth doing, it's worth doing badly." Whilst my Christian faith inspires me to want to be the best I can, out of love for the God who loves me, it also recognises that I will make many mistakes. Perfection is impossible, but thank God, forgiveness is ever-present. I often say to my churches that if everything they try succeeds, they're clearly not being bold enough. It's not a call to underprepare, or to fail to plan how to respond to risks inherent in our actions. It's an assertion that we shouldn't let fear of making mistakes paralyse us. Martin Luther at the start of the Protestant Reformation had his own take on it when he told his followers, "If you must sin, sin boldly." Much can, of course, depend on a single knife-edge ruling. When VAR disallowed a West Ham goal late in their recent fixture against Arsenal, that decision might prove to affect both who wins the English Premier League and who gets relegated. With careers potentially to be saved or lost on the outcome of close decisions in vital matches, the desire for certainty is understandable. Yet a football game can lose its entire momentum whilst officials pore over a borderline case for minutes on end. If pausing play ruins a spectacle, arguably we've lost the plot. I believe we need to accept fallibility among officials, just as we expect mistakes from the players on the field. It's part of the game. In football, as in life more generally, we need to remember the actual purpose behind what we're doing and be wary of the perfectionism that detracts from our true aim. So, maybe the really tough call facing football administrators today is whether it's time for VAR to be shown a red card.
That was Thought for the Day with the Right Reverend Dr. David Walker, Bishop of Manchester. It's 9 minutes to eight.
There is a public health emergency of international concern in the Democratic Republic of Congo. That is what the WHO told us over the weekend. The concern is over a particular species of Ebola virus, which has already killed more than 80 people. The Director General for the Africa Centre for Disease Control, Dr. Jean Kaseya, says there are still several strains of Ebola which have no vaccines or medicines to treat them, and there is a pressing need for vaccines and medicines to be manufactured and manufactured in African countries.
Currently, I'm on panic mode because people are dying. I don't have medicines. I don't have vaccine to support countries. Yesterday, I called for a meeting of all partners. We have some candidate vaccine. We hope that we can have something in the next coming weeks. This is the equity issue. Western countries, they don't understand that when Africa is affected, they are also at risk because people are flying every day.
Let's talk first to the BBC's Emery Makamena, who is in Kinshasa. Emery, give us a sense of what it is that at the moment is being done to try to contain this outbreak.
Good morning. For the moment, teams have deployed on the ground and they are setting up the treatment centers. Those who have been affected haven't been received in proper Ebola treatment centers, as teams are still busy to set up those treatment centers in Bunia in particular, where the health minister and teams deployed yesterday with kits and everything. But that's what is happening. The health teams are busy catching up with a species of Ebola that has been spreading for the last 1 month, at least one month.
And when we talk about treatment centres, these are isolation centres, but there isn't really much in the way of treatment at the moment, is there, that can be given?
Yes, as Dr. Jean Kaseya was saying there, there is no specific therapeutics for this species of Ebola, the Budibungio. But this is not the first time it's happening here in the country. In 2012, it emerged in Isiro province in the north of the country. And health teams here have told us that they do have public health measures that they've used in the past, and also in the 16th outbreaks of Ebola that have hit the DRC.
Okay, Emery Makamena, thank you very much for talking to us. Let us talk now to Professor Trudy Lang, who's Professor of Global Health at the University of Oxford. Good morning to you.
Good morning.
Thanks for coming on. How worried are you about this?
Well, it's been made a public health emergency of concern for three really good reasons. Firstly, as we've just heard from colleagues in Africa, that it's in really difficult areas. You know, these are mining towns, they're difficult to reach, transient workers. And also it's hard to get an idea of just how significant the scale of the outbreak is, because it's so hard to get diagnostics. Secondly, as we heard, there's no vaccine as yet. Colleagues at CEPI and other organisations will be working round the clock to get those manufactured. But the other point is about community education and really reaching these vulnerable communities to really help them understand the risk that's unfolding and how they can prevent further transmission, and also to get encourage them to seek care.
From what you know, is that information lacking? So, for instance, in bodily fluids and all the rest of it, the obvious stuff that you would think you would need to do, is it all being done?
So yesterday I was on several calls with colleagues that I've been working on this still ongoing Mpox outbreak that's in the region. And this is one of the biggest concerns they have. And what they're seeing is patients coming in or in communities where we're seeing the highest mortality, actually slightly higher in women, which does suggest it's caregivers. And sadly, we've got some healthcare workers already that have lost their lives very tragically. And so getting to understand what the beliefs and behaviours and perceptions are is really important. So we definitely need some local studies and local action to really help educate and inform. And whilst we're waiting for a vaccine, of course, really the best intervention we can have is to make sure that a lot of work is done locally, supported globally, and lots of collaboration to find out just exactly how many cases there are, but also work with the communities to try and prevent infection through education and support locally.
Is the likelihood then that there are many more infections? At the moment we're talking about 246 suspected cases, 80 deaths. Your feeling is it's going to be quite a lot more than that?
Well, considering where this is unfolding, and as we've heard, there's the cases that we've had reported and confirmed in Kinshasa and Kampala. And because it's so hard to get these cases diagnosed, if the local tests we can use need adjusting for this particular species. And then the laboratories where you can do genomic sequencing are very far from these settings. And so it's quite likely, also because of the beliefs and perceptions around what's unfolding locally, it's quite likely there's more cases than we know about so far.
When you say the beliefs and perceptions, meaning what?
So what's common when you have a new outbreak is people really not understanding what the causes are and what can be done. And the best thing that is really important to get underway is local experts doing some studies with those communities to find out what their beliefs are and what's causing them, and then working with the local community to explain exactly how this infection is caused and transmitted and what practices they need to change to keep safe and prevent transmission.
And then just briefly, Professor, you mentioned the possibility of a vaccine. Is there a realistic chance of a vaccine soon?
Yeah, very much so. And what's happened over the last few years is organisations like CEPI are working with colleagues across the continent to take, there's already an Ebola vaccine for the previous species, the Zaire species, and swapping in the surface protein for this particular species, and then getting that manufactured, but of course tested, and then the ring vaccine approaches in as quickly as possible.
Okay, Professor Trudy Lang from the University of Oxford, thank you very much.
On BBC iPlayer.
I'm proud of this casino.
We're $9,000 down this month. Someone's been stealing.
Starring Sheridan Smith and Michael Socha.
What are you doing here?
What are you doing here?
The odds are stacked against them.
I'll get your money.
No, you won't.
I think you've got problems.
I have got problems. I'm going to be kicked out on the street.
The Cage.
He lies. You should know that if you're his girlfriend.
I'm not his girlfriend.
All right, I am standing here.
Watch all episodes on BBC iPlayer.
Couple of minutes to eight. The weather comes this morning from Stav Danaeus. Morning again, Stav.
Good morning to you, Justin and Anna. Thank you very much. Now, after an unseasonably cold week, temperatures are on the rise as we head through this upcoming week. And as we head into the bank holiday weekend, we could be hitting the high 20s Celsius for some of us as high pressure builds in to bring increasing amounts of sunshine with southerly winds, but also increasing humidity, which could spark off a few heavy thundery showers. In the short term, though, we still have low pressure dominating, certainly as we head through tonight. But today, a couple of week weather fronts across the country are bringing more cloud and some showery rain. Now, showery, pretty much from the word go, across western England and into Wales. Some heavier bursts of rain across South Wales at the moment. Best of any early sunshine has been across northern Scotland and eastern England, but it will fade as showers and cloud become more widespread this afternoon. Some of them will continue to be heavy and thundery in places. Northern Ireland, a few showers, but mostly dry, but rather cloudy. Winds light south-southwesterly today. Temperatures up on yesterday's 12 to 16 Celsius. Now, as we head through tonight, low pressure sweeps across the country. It turns wetter and windier for all. Very mild as well, with temperatures no lower than around 7 to 11 degrees. Some good news, though, for the farmers and gardeners with some rain tonight. That clears tomorrow morning to leave sunshine and showers again. Some of them will be heavy, a little bit milder tomorrow than today.
Thank you, Stav. You're listening to Today with Justin Webb and Anna Foster.
It's 8 o'clock on Monday, the 18th of May. The headlines this morning: supporters of the Labour leadership hopeful Andy Burnham have attacked his rival Wes Streeting over pro-EU remarks, which they think will make it more difficult for the Greater Manchester Mayor to win the Makerfield by-election. We'll be talking to a Red Wall MP and to the Justice Secretary, David Lammy, after the news. A BBC investigation has found that people smugglers in France have been telling migrants to pay for illegal crossings through UK-registered companies. Rwanda has announced its tightening screening of its Congolese border because of the Ebola outbreak, which has killed more than 80 people. And gnomes have been given permission to make a rare appearance at this week's Chelsea Flower Show.
And coming up in the next hour of the programme, England's Aaron Rye has won golf's latest major title, having never been higher than 19th before. We'll hear from his childhood coach in the next half hour. And Russell T Davies is back with a new series, Tiptoe, about neighbours rubbing along or not in Manchester.
This is Leo, my gay neighbour. Oh, that's not offensive.
Well, it is, so watch it.
I used to walk into a room and just go, ta-da! Now I tiptoe, just in case.
BBC News is read by Chris Aldridge.
Allies of the Mayor of Greater Manchester, Andy Burnham, have criticised his Labour leadership rival, Wes Streeting, for saying that Britain's future lies in the European Union. They suggest the former Health Secretary's intervention was unhelpful because highlighting the issue of Brexit could make it more difficult for Mr Burnham to beat reform in the forthcoming by-election in Makerfield in Greater Manchester. Winning the seat could allow Mr Burnham to challenge Sir Keir Starmer and become Prime Minister. Writing in The Express, the reform leader Nigel Farage said Andy Burnham wanted to rejoin the EU and the voters in Makerfield deserved honesty. Our political correspondent Joe Pike reports.
Labour's 2024 general election manifesto promised that there would be no return to the single market, the customs union or freedom of movement. If either Andy Burnham or Wes Streeting were to succeed Sir Keir Starmer, the UK would have a prime minister who supported rejoining the EU at some point in the future. Over the weekend, both men reaffirmed that position, but Mr. Streeting did it far more wholeheartedly. He said in a speech that Brexit was a catastrophic mistake. Allies of Mr. Burnham believe that intervention was unhelpful, since it highlights an issue the Greater Manchester Mayor wants to avoid in the by-election. He faces a battle to beat Reform UK in a Leave-supporting area. Yet Mr. Burnham said in an interview on Saturday that in the long term there was a case for rejoining the EU, although he wasn't advocating that during this campaign. A spokesperson for Mr. Streeting told the BBC that he'd always been a pro-European and the party shouldn't fear debate or ideas.
A BBC investigation has discovered people smugglers in France are saying to migrants that they can pay to cross the Channel illegally through a network of UK-registered companies. An undercover researcher posing as someone trying to make a small boat crossing was told by gang members about British shops and businesses that would accept payment in either cash or as a bank transfer. Josie Hannett reports.
Our undercover researcher made contact with two smugglers in a camp in Dunkirk. Both said payment for a crossing could be taken in the UK. One said money could be sent to the bank account of a car wash in Cambridgeshire or a wholesale business in Newcastle. He also said cash could be paid at a phone shop in London. We secretly filmed workers there agreeing to take nearly £3,000 to pay for two people to cross the channel. When challenged, those involved later denied smuggling. The Home Office says it's working relentlessly to tackle the networks behind small boat crossings.
And you can watch the documentary The Smuggling Business Undercover on BBC iPlayer now. Figures from the National Crime Agency show the number of arrests for offences linked to people smuggling has gone up by more than 55% in a year. The agency says it was involved in around 300 arrests in the year to April 2026, compared with 190 the year before. It says there's been an increase in the number of officers deployed to focus on organised immigration crime. The government is proposing measures in England and Wales that will make parents and carers more accountable when children offend. It comes after a report last month which concluded that the fatal stabbings in Southport of three young girls in 2024 could have been prevented if the killer's parents had intervened in the years leading up to it. Here's our senior UK correspondent, Seema Kotecha.
The Ministry of Justice says its figures show 8 out of 10 prolific offenders in England and Wales committed their first crime as a child. As part of the proposals, ministers want parents and carers to be made to take more responsibility. They will do this by strengthening and expanding parenting orders. These are issued by the courts and can require guardians to attend counselling or guidance sessions with a child or risk a fine. Parenting orders are already available but aren't being widely used. The government is also proposing piloting a new youth court where judges and justice services work together to tackle the causes of offending. But critics say the plans rely too heavily on pilots and reviews rather than bold, ambitious action.
Rwanda says it's tightening screening at its border with the Democratic Republic of Congo because of a deadly outbreak of the Ebola virus. More than 80 people have died from the disease, and experts have warned there's no vaccine, nor is there an effective drug treatment for this species of Ebola. Trudy Lang is a professor of global health at the University of Oxford who supports local research during outbreaks. She told this programme that more has to be done on the ground to understand people's behaviour in relation to the disease.
Whilst we're waiting for a vaccine, of course, really the best intervention we can have is to make sure that a lot of work is done locally, supported globally, and lots of collaboration to find out just exactly how many cases there are, but also work with the communities.
Ryanair has reported a rise in revenues for its financial year in the 12 months to the end of March. The airline said they're up 11% year on year to around 15.5 billion euros, or around 13.5 billion pounds. But the Irish carrier warned that the war in the Middle East and volatility around the cost and potential supply of fuel had clouded its outlook for the year ahead. The government says it's introducing tighter rules and stricter checks to stop firms carrying waste from exploiting legal loopholes and dumping rubbish illegally. Campaigners say the current rules are so lax that they managed to successfully register a cow so it had a licence to dispose of household rubbish. More from our Rural Affairs correspondent, Jenny Kumar.
Under the changes due to come in next year, waste handlers will have to prove they are qualified to transport waste. There will be identity, criminal record and technical checks before they can receive a permit. Permit numbers will need to be displayed in advertising, including on vans. And those mishandling waste will face up to 5 years in prison, while the Environment Agency will have stronger powers to revoke permits and issue enforcement notices. The waste industry body, the Environmental Services Association, has welcomed the changes, saying it's been campaigning for them for more than a decade.
The former Conservative Chancellor, Sir Sajid Javid, has said the UK is in real peril and risks being torn apart unless people regain a shared sense of what unites them. He's the joint chairman of a new research project called the National Conversation. Those taking part will be asked questions about where they live and will be invited to leave a minute-long voice note outlining their thoughts on what brings people together and what divides them. Sir Sajid told us they wanted to hear the collective wisdom of people across the UK.
Obviously in their own words, with their own the emotion, the texture they want to give to their language. And we can take millions of voice notes into account and listen to them. And the reason we can do that, by the way, is because of new technology, especially AI, which will mean that every person that takes part, we will listen to every voice note, every single word.
In golf, Aaron Rye has become the first Englishman in more than a century to win the US PGA Championship. His victory at the Aronimink course in Pennsylvania was sealed when he finished 3 shots clear of his nearest rival. He said it was the culmination of years of hard work.
Every level is more and more competitive, and every level demands more of you, more of your game, more of your mind, more of the things that you have to do in order to compete at all of the different levels. So to be stood here, to be able to be competing in major championships, to get into contention and to continue to play well on the Sunday is just very rewarding and shows just a lot of really good things that we're doing to get to this point.
The Chelsea Flower Show this week will lift its ban on garden gnomes for only the second time in its 113-year history. The gnomes on display will then be auctioned off for charity. Daniela Ralph reports.
In the refined garden designs of Chelsea Flower Show, gnomes are usually a no-no. But this year there'll be a scattering of them around the place, many painted by celebrities. The gnome from the Queen musician Sir Brian May holds a guitar, and there's a bejewelled one from the broadcaster and politician Dame Fluella Benjamin. All the gnomes will be sold off to raise money for the Royal Horticultural Society's campaign for school gardening. Elsewhere on the 20-acre site, there's a garden from Parkinson's UK, which includes a rose with hardly any scent, a reminder that a loss of smell is an early symptom of the disease. And the King's Foundation Garden, which had creative input from keen gardener Sir David Beckham, contains plenty of the King's favourite flower, the delphinium.
And that was Daniela Ralph.
Thank you, Chris. It's 8:10. In just over a month's time, it will be exactly 10 years since this.
The British people have spoken and the answer is we're out.
A momentous day for Britain, for Europe, as the country embarks on a new and uncertain future, outside the EU and under a different leader.
Well, a decade on from the Brexit referendum, the UK has left the EU. But the question of our future out of Europe or back in it again is still talked about. And it's raised its head once again as a battle for the Labour leadership begins to get into gear. There is no official contest yet, but Wes Streeting's resignation from the Cabinet and Andy Burnham's aim of returning to Parliament as an MP make their intentions clear. And while they start to set out their ideological positions to try to win over potential backers, the issue of the UK and Europe has, perhaps unexpectedly, given the domestic problems that are causing issues for the Prime Minister, come back into focus. Now, at the weekend, Wes Streeting described leaving the EU as a catastrophic mistake, asserting that Britain's future lies one day back in the European Union. Last September, Andy Burnham told the Labour Party conference, "I hope in my lifetime I see this country rejoin." But does he want to be defined by that view in a by-election for a seat which voted for Brexit and has seen reform mount a strong challenge to Labour? Well, on Saturday, Andy Burnham told ITV there was still a case for long-term reintegration, but that he was not, in his words, advocating that in this by-election. Well, let's speak to Jonathan Hinder, who's the Labour MP for Pendle and Clitheroe. Good morning.
Good morning.
Did you want this to be about Brexit again?
Absolutely not. And I'm astonished that we've got to this stage so quickly in this Labour leadership contest, because that's what it is. Let's call it what it is. You know, if I went into the Wallace Hartley pub in Cole, in my constituency, and I said to them, you know that thing we just did, which paralysed our politics, which tore our country apart, that we said we were done with, we were leaving in the past because it's finally been delivered. And I said to them, we're going to reopen it. And we're going to reopen it all. In fact, the single market is going to be back on the table with freedom of movement, the single currency, Schengen. What's our budget going to be, budget arrangements going to be with the EU? They would rightly look at me as if I had gone mad. They'd say, you are off your rocker if you think the priority for the British people right now is to restart this debate. And I think the context in which this is being had is also quite extraordinary. You know, we are just over a week after we took a real beating in our working class heartlands. It's a very long list. We're talking about the Hartlepools, the Grimsbys, Barnsley, places like Wigan, where this by-election is going to be. And we were losing to a party which, until recently, was called the Brexit Party. And
to
suggest that the solution now
is
for us to reopen that debate is just staggering. And the Labour Party is in an existential crisis. It really is. And the idea that we can reconnect to our working class base by reopening this debate is just a staggering level of out of touch, I'm afraid.
The fact is, by the way, are you an Andy Burnham supporter? I realise it is still a hypothetical contest at the moment, but we know it's going to happen. Will you be backing Andy Burnham?
Well, we don't know how many candidates are going to put themselves forward. I'm looking forward to seeing who does put themselves forward, but there's absolutely no way that I could support someone who thinks the way to unite our country at the moment is to go big on rejoining the EU,
making that
a cornerstone of their campaign, which obviously we've seen one of the candidates do.
It is because it's come up, but it was only the Labour conference last year in September, where Andy Burnham himself said, long term, I'm going to be honest, I hope in my lifetime I see this country rejoin. The Wigan borough, which obviously includes Makerfield, as you know, voted 64% to leave the European Union. So if Labour didn't start talking about it now, potentially Reform would start talking about it very quickly as soon as the campaign began, wouldn't they?
Well, it's up to Andy Burnham to decide what he wants his platform to be to win this by-election and to also potentially become the leader. So those are questions for him. But I think,
I know, but isn't it a bit of a disingenuous, but you know, when you put one flag in the sand and then suddenly the by-election opportunity offered to you is people who don't necessarily agree with that and you start to retreat away from it. You know, people want, they want politicians who stand by their conviction and don't change it based on the position that they find themselves in.
It's about priorities. So the key thing about what happened over the weekend is it became the cornerstone of one of the leadership candidates' campaign. This is not a priority for the British people. There are lots of my constituents who voted to remain. There are nearly half of the country at the time voted to remain. That's fine. But the priority of the British people right now is not to reopen this debate, to rewire our relationship with the European Union, which we're only just in the process of settling down into after Brexit, which was finally delivered after all of those ruptures, after the 2019 general election, where my party was beaten with that disastrous policy of telling the public that they got it wrong and that we want to go back to it. And we're doing that again. It's just absolutely brainless.
Some conversations, it sounds like, stern conversations to be had then with Labour colleagues. Thank you, Jonathan Hinder, the Labour MP for Pendle and Clitheroe.
And listening to that, on the line is David Lammy, the Deputy Prime Minister, Secretary of State for Justice. Good morning to you.
Good morning.
Do you agree with him that the bringing up of the EU and our potential future membership again was, in his words, a staggering level of out of touch?
Well, Justin, I think that we've had an extraordinary own goal for 10 days. And it's hugely important that we come together, that we unify, and that we remember that we're in government, Now, the truth is, I was very sad when Wes Streeting decided to leave government. But just as Michael Heseltine left Thatcher's government, just as Robin Cook left Blair's government, just as James Purnell left Gordon Brown's government, people do resign when they can't sign up to collective responsibility. We stood on a manifesto 22 months ago. It was a manifesto that had clear red lines, but I made a commitment as the shadow foreign secretary and then as foreign secretary that we would be reconnecting with Europe. I was pleased to go back to the European Union as foreign secretary. We are hopefully about to sign an SPS deal with our European colleagues, a work experience deal with our European colleagues. I brokered a new security and defence pact with our European colleagues. So yes, of course, the promises that were made by Nigel Farage on breakfast that we would get richer, well, they proved to be wrong. We are poorer as a result. The promises he made on immigration, that it would come down, he was wrong. It has gone up. I wish that we were being crystal clear about what reform and Nigel Farage would deliver and have delivered for this country. By the way, taking 5 million from crypto and getting on with the business of delivering for the British people. That's what we've got to do.
Yes, but what Wes Streeting says, is we've got to be bold. We as a party have got to be bold, and we haven't been bold. And he would suggest as well that most Labour supporters, not necessarily in this one constituency, but most Labour supporters would back a long-term commitment. Not a commitment, as you say, you're committed to a manifesto, but a long-term commitment to rejoin the European Union. Are you saying that that long-term commitment for you, for the Prime Minister, is off the cards?
Justin, Wes Streeting is now a backbencher.
Is it off the cards?
Justin, can I answer the question?
Yes.
He is a backbencher. He's free to say whatever he wants.
But that wasn't my question. My question is it off the cards for you and the Prime Minister?
Well, I did answer your question. What
is the answer?
Well, Justin, if you just pause and allow me to answer the question, I'll give it to you.
Okay.
I am in the cabinet. We stood on a manifesto that had clear red lines. We are committed to that manifesto. I'm not going to speculate about the next Labour manifesto. We've got 3 years until we get to that point. I want to deliver for the British people. I'm not interested in comment and debate.
Well, that's
I
very don't clear. Want the Labour no, Party you're being to get very into clear. Comment and you're, debate. You're being very clear, I and you're saying you won't rule it out long term.
To be in the business of commitment and delivery for the British people. That's the lesson of the election 10 days ago. We don't need another 10 weeks of discussion and debate. We need to deliver for the British people on cost of living and the things that they asked us to do
and on
that general election 22 months ago.
On that, Andy Burnham says, what is the path? We need a different path completely, put more things back under stronger public control, energy, housing, water, transport. And we had the Mayor of West Yorkshire on the programme the other day saying water definitely, in her view, should be back in public ownership. What's your view of that?
Well, again, we have collective responsibility. We are putting National Rail back in public hands. We have brought GB Energy. We have a new wealth fund. So we are committed to public ownership where it's right.
Of water?
Water, it would cost billions. Billions that I think are better spent in other areas. That is our manifesto commitment.
But that's weird,
and
isn't
that
it?
Is what we stand by.
Why does Justin, Andy Burnham say these Justin, things if they would cost billions? And I've seen the figure of
Justin,
100 billion
wheeled
out. You
know very well that Andy Burnham is not in Parliament. He's not subject to collective responsibility. Neither is Wes Streeting.
But he wants to be Prime
I'm
Minister.
Deputy Prime Minister. I've put the position that it is. We could be discussing my Justice White Paper that I came on to talk about this morning.
And we will
22
in a
young people died as a result of knife crime. I'd like to talk about that. You want to talk about...
Andy Burnham wants to be Prime Minister.
I'm determined to talk about the government's agenda for delivery on the British people.
We will get to that. Hang on a second. You can't blame me for bringing it up. Andy
I'm
Burnham,
not blaming you. We're having a good discussion. I've been at this business for a quarter of a century.
Look,
I know what you're up to.
Yeah,
let's get the
what
Labour
I'm
Party
up to is
having a public disagreement. agreement. Let's get the Labour Party talking about everything
you're
other
already
than what
having
the British
it.
People
you're
want.
You're already having it. You've got to be able
end
to discuss
up with
it.
A reform government. It's my job to push back on that and to urge colleagues to demonstrate the discipline that's required in government. We have the opportunity of a lifetime to deliver on behalf of the British people. This is not a sixth form debate. It is delivery on behalf of the British people. Why?
Who is having the sixth form debate?
Because they've got a... Well, in the end, right across the country in sixth forms, you can discuss what the position should be on
Europe.
And
that's what Andy Burnham's doing, is it, in West Streeting?
Our position...
It's a sixth form debate.
Justin, our position was set out in a manifesto, voted on by the British people. It was voted on, that was just 22 months ago. There will be another opportunity at the next election. We have to get on and deliver on their behalf. And I say to colleagues, 10 days of this, fine. I think the British people will forgive us for the introspection. 10 weeks of this and we're in desperate trouble. We'll be out of office. And what we'll be ushering in is Farage.
So hang on, it's going to go all the way to the by-election, obviously, but it's going to go beyond if Andy Burnham wins. And you want him to win, don't you? So you're going to be campaigning in Makerfield for someone to come into Parliament and challenge Keir Starmer in what you say is a sixth form debate on these issues.
Well, look, let me be clear. There is no contest at this point in time. No one has come forward with the signatures required. Of course, I will be campaigning for the Labour candidate in Makerfield. Now, there's still
well,
a decision
say, of
to
course.
Be made.
I mean, do you really want him to come to
by
Parliament?
The NEC, of course, to see if Andy is the candidate. I've known Andy for over 25 years. We were both proteges under the great Tessa Jowell. He's very able, very committed. Of course I'll be working alongside him. If he's the candidate, to see him come back to Westminster, he'll be a huge asset, of course.
And he says you need to be on a different path completely.
I'm very clear that you win when you're unified and when you're together. That Labour on... We were only in power, you know, in the 20th century for 22 years. I hope we get a lot more in the 21st. And I hope that what we've seen over the last 10 days does not set back that cause and therefore the cause of working people. That's why I came into politics. That's what motivates me every day. And I care about those young people who are dying on those streets, those young people in our youth justice system, the 90,000 prisoners that I'm responsible as Justice Secretary. That's a serious business on behalf of the British people. And that's why I'm less interested in debates. I'm more interested in delivery. And
you said earlier, you said in an earlier
have
interview,
that as our North Star.
OK, you said in an earlier interview that there is no timetable for Keir Starmer to step down. Why not?
Keir Starmer fought an election, won a historic majority 22 months ago. I spoke to him over the weekend. He is committed to delivering for the British people. And let me say this personally. He is the most resilient person I know. He had my loyalty then, and I happen to believe that loyalty, trust, conviction matter as personal attributes.
So he will fight. If there is an election, if there is a leadership contest.
Now, he will continue to fight on behalf of the British people. And of course, all of us in relation to this by-election will be up to see a Labour MP returned.
And then if a Labour MP is returned, Keir Starmer will see him off when it comes to a challenge for the leadership. He's intending, is he, so far as you know, to stay and to fight if there is a fight to be had.
Yes, but there is no fight at the moment. There
yes,
is
but if
no
there
contest.
Is one. If there
what
is one.
There is people like me who've been in the Labour movement for most of my life being crystal clear that unity, pulling together all of us, is what will deliver for the British people. Introspection and internecine warfare, effectively some of our colleagues lighting the match and standing in the petrol, that is not what's going to deliver for the British people. That's not what's going to deliver for the British people. What that will usher in is Farage. So let us pull together, let us come together, let us unite, and let us get on with the huge privilege of being in government, which is rare, rare for the Labour movement and rare for the Labour Party.
Let us talk about the youth justice measures that you're coming up with today. We had someone on the programme earlier on from an alliance of youth justice organisations who was by no means persuaded that they were wrong, what you were doing, but she did feel very strongly that there were already things in place that ought to be acted on. And specifically, her point, I think, about all of this is that a lot of these families are very vulnerable. Yeah. And this has got to be as much about help as it has about potential future punishment. Is that fair, do you think?
It is fair. So just to step back, this is the biggest change to the youth justice system in over 20 years. 20 years ago, we had over 100,000 young people passing through our youth courts. We had 4,000 young people in our prisons. Now it's about 14,000 or just under passing through our courts and just 400 in our prisons. But those that are left are sadly 8 out of 10 prolific offenders. They go on to reoffend and offend. Many of them are suffering trauma. Many of them have mental health issues. These are a very vulnerable, difficult group of young people. And that's why we need to change the system, give the judge more powers to intervene, new youth division, youth intensive courts for those judges, problem solving, working with parents. Are there drug addiction? Is there alcohol addiction? Is there mental health issues in that family? How can the judge make sure that health, education, and yes, the parents come together on behalf of that child to stop the reoffending behaviour? That's the change that we're making. Remembering, of course, that very sadly on our streets, even though we have seen a reduction, I'm very pleased about that since we came to power, too many young people are dying on our streets in this country, across the country. Too many young people are falling victim to violent crime. And any young person in custody for a protracted period, sadly, also will ultimately mix with adults and often become more dangerous, more worrying. That's why we've got to do all we can early to stop that crime developing.
David Lammy, thank you very much.
Thank you.
28 minutes past eight now, time for the sport. Here's Carthy.
Morning, thank you very much. An English golfer, Aaron Rye, has won golf's PGA Championship for the first time in over a century.
Aaron Rye of England taps it in for a closing par to a brilliant 65 at 9 under par. He has won the US PGA, the first Englishman to do it for 107 years. Another British golfing hero by the name of Aaron Rye, who has romped away from the packed leaderboard to take victory here at Aronimink.
Rye's previous best at a major had been 19th place. This was an unexpected and understated 9-under-par victory for the 31-year-old from Wolverhampton.
There's a lot of incredible and historic English players over those 100 years who have gone on to achieve incredible things and had phenomenal careers. But to win this event and to be a person that's the first one to have won it in such a long time from England is an amazing thing and something to be extremely proud of.
Well, a man who knows Aaron Rye well is the man who was involved in teaching him how to play golf from the age of seven. Morning, Darren Prosser, and congratulations on being part of this. You have coached a major champion. How did you cope with that final round last night with so many players challenging him for the title?
Yeah, it was. Looks like it was going to be a real sprint, didn't it, with seven or eight people having a chance to win. But Aaron came through it fantastic. The last few holes, he kept his mentality, a real level-headed guy that he is, and he was so calm on the course and he made some fantastic putts. I'm just so happy for him.
Yeah, and we have just heard Rye speak. Anyone that's watched him will know he is a quiet man. He's clearly an understated man. How will he deal with the attention that will come with being a major champion?
I don't think it'll change him much at all, to be honest. I think what you see on the TV is how he is in everything that he does. He's so level, he's so humble, he's such a nice guy, he's got time for everyone. Obviously, there'll be a little few more demands on him now, being a major champion. But as far as the playing schedule goes, it's just the major championships that he's going to be in the next few years now. So he knows for sure that he can put those in his schedule first thing. There'll be a few more invites into bigger events as well. But I don't think it'll change him too much. I think it'll will just give him the proof that that he can go on and do even better things and hopefully win more majors.
Yeah, it's nice to have that certainty of playing in the majors, isn't it?
Yeah, yeah, it certainly
he's,
is. Yeah.
He's quite distinctive. He wears a glove on each hand. Is that something he was doing when he was with you at the age of seven?
No, it wasn't. Those gloves are called Macquet gloves, and they're really used when it's raining and you get a good grip with both hands. But I think it's just one day he was over at the range in Wolverhampton, the old good old British Wolverhampton weather, and he was cold, so he put them on and he hit the ball okay, and I quite like the feel of these, so he stuck with them.
He
uses them all the way through. Yes.
And they're made specifically for him, I think, by someone in the West Midlands. It's all a very interesting story. And his relationship with his dad is slightly reminiscent of the Tiger Woods Earl relationship, isn't it? Oh, I think we may have lost Darren Prosser. That was a question about his childhood. So the childhood coach of Aaron Rye. Aaron, are you still there? Can you hear me? No, I'm afraid we can't hear from him. Well, that's a shame, because it was lovely to hear those memories of Darren Prosser, who used to coach with Aaron Rye, who has just become the first English golfer to win the PGA Championship for 107 years. A couple of other headlines for you. England's Lottie Woad has won the Kroger Queen City Championship. That's her second LPGA title. In rugby union, England are Women's Six Nations champions for the eighth year in a row. They also won the Grand Slam with a 43-28 win over France. And the former Scotland and British and Irish Lions rugby player Scott Hastings has died at the age of 61. He was part of the last Scotland side to win a Grand Slam. We'll be celebrating Scott Hastings' life and his sporting achievements after 8:30. A couple of football headlines for you to finish. West Ham are 2 points from safety in the Premier League after a 3-1 defeat in Newcastle. They could be relegated tomorrow. Celtic have apologised to Hearts and say they will cooperate with a police investigation into the pitch invasion at the conclusion of Celtic's dramatic 3-1 win over Hearts to win the Scottish Premiership title. And all of the weekend's results, including details of Manchester City's FA Cup win, are on the BBC Sport website.
Carthy, thank you. I know we can turn now to Adam Rutherford to tell us about this morning's start of the week, because he's here in the studio. Morning, Adam.
Morning, Justin. So we've been farming for about 10,000 years now, which means that almost nothing you've ever eaten could be considered natural. 8 billion people, food insecurity, the climate crisis and the sixth great extinction are upon us. There is, in fact, enough food to feed 10 billion, but what we eat, how we farm and our relationship with nature is all upside down. So we've got a farmer, a scientist and a novelist who are going to tell us how we can feed the world and save the planet. So it's nature and the future of farming and food just after breakfast on Start the Week.
Thank you, Adam. It's 27 minutes to nine now. You're listening to Today on BBC Radio 4 with Justin Webb and Anna Foster, and Chris Aldridge has a summary of the news.
Allies of the Mayor of Greater Manchester, Andy Burnham, have criticised his Labour leadership rival, Wes Streeting, for saying that Britain's future lies in the European Union. They suggest the former Health Secretary's intervention was unhelpful because highlighting the issue of Brexit could make it more difficult for Mr Burnham to beat reform in the forthcoming by-election in Makerfield in Greater Manchester. Winning the seat could allow Mr Burnham to challenge Sir Keir Starmer and become Prime Minister. The Deputy Prime Minister, David Lammy, told this programme that Sir Keir would continue to fight for the British people. He called for unity in Labour and said the last 10 days have been an own goal. A BBC investigation has discovered people smugglers in France are saying to migrants that they can pay to cross the Channel illegally through a network of UK-registered companies. The Home Office says it's working relentlessly to tackle the networks behind small boat crossings. Rwanda says it's tightening screening at its border with the Democratic Republic of Congo because of a deadly outbreak of the Ebola virus. More than 80 people have died from the disease.
Thank you for that. 26 minutes to nine. The new Director General of the BBC, Matt Britton, begins work today. His job, of course, to make the organisation fit for the future. He says he joins with humility to listen, to learn, to lead and to serve the public. He acknowledges that this is a moment of real risk for the corporation, but real opportunity, he says as well. He says the BBC needs to be where the stories are and where the audiences are as well. Peter Barron is here in the studio, former editor of the BBC's Newsnight and head of communications at Google, where, of course, he worked with Matt Britton, and Asha Tala as well, Golden Globe winning TV producer who founded the production company Rough Cut TV. Morning to you both.
Good morning.
Right, so he sits down, Ash, he gets a a flat white or whatever his coffee of choice is. The desk at the moment is empty. What does he do first, do you think?
Well, I don't know that he's even going to have time to get a flat white. I've just entered the building right by him this morning, and there was a bank of photographers following to the coffee machine.
How is he looking?
He's looking scared. No, not true. I think he's got a job on to turn this organisation from a broadcast first organisation into a digital organisation. And I think the time pressure he's under to make that happen is immense. The BBC is brilliant at making television shows. I think what the BBC has been a little lethargic at is making it digital first and really meeting young audiences in particular where they are, which is online. And I think there's a real clock on it because one of the things that frightens me most of all is when people say, we'll miss the BBC when it's gone. I certainly will, and you certainly will. But I'm not sure that our children will, and or their children will, because they're not. They don't have the nostalgia around the BBC. So Matt's job is to quickly make this so that when our children are making the decisions, which won't be that long, that they are putting the BBC right at the heart of that.
And in practical terms then, Peter Barron, what does that mean he has to do, or the BBC has to do under him?
Yeah, well, I think the sense of urgency is really there. And it would be lovely, wouldn't it, to come in as a new DG and sort of survey the landscape for a few months and then come to some conclusions. But as Ash says, I don't think he's got that opportunity. I think he needs to take action really quickly on a couple of big areas. One, well, there's clearly the digital point that Ash makes. I think also public trust is a huge issue. Unfortunately, there are swathes of the British population for whom the BBC is no longer for them, you know, both on the left and the right. And as Ash
said, what does he do in practical terms to get them back?
Well, I think there is a making the case externally for the BBC, and that's clearly a very, very important part of the role. I think a lot of young people these days say, "Well, I don't consume the BBC." Actually, the reality is they do consume the BBC, but maybe they don't realise they're consuming the BBC.
And on platforms that aren't currently the BBC. I mean, not necessarily, for instance, on a linear channel. Actually, that's important, isn't it?
Correct, because we all know what the iPlayer is, and we all know. But I think the BBC has to start commissioning, I think, for a digital first way rather than it just being a tool to advertise our shows. So whenever I make a show for the BBC, there's often a digital element of that advertises the shows. We need to think about that digital element being the show, not the thing that supports the
show.
So
people are then watching it on YouTube or wherever in the future, they'll be getting content, as it were.
Correct. But I don't mean just watching the shows that you make. I don't mean The Traitors. I don't mean any comedies. I mean shows that are specifically made for that online space where the BBC has diverted resource away from broadcast to digital.
Isn't there a risk? Well, two risks, I suppose, Peter. Number one, that people who perfectly like at the moment watching programmes see the resourcing of those programmes reduced in order to pay for what you're both suggesting ought to happen. But also, number two, that actually when people watch this stuff, they won't know it's the BBC, so they still won't want to pay for it.
Well, there certainly has to be a way of finding a way to let people know that they're watching and enjoying the BBC. But I think you touched on the resources question, and I think this is a hugely important one, because for too long, the BBC has tried to save money and cut back on services, but kept everything going. And I think that's been a problem. You know, the simple question is, could you make a world-beating broadcasting operation for £5 billion a year? Well, I think, of course, you can. The trouble is that the old infrastructure, you know, the iPlayer and Sounds are wonderful pieces of technology, but they kind of open a door on an old infrastructure with the old programmes that are still funded and made in much the same way. And I think he needs to be bold and actually switch some things off, turn off some things, and then focus on the...
Like what?
Well, I'm not going to make judgments on this show about what should be switched off. But, you know, do we really need, in this digital day and age, you know, four television channels and a huge array of radio channels? That doesn't seem to make sense.
Ash, you're nodding at that, Ash.
Well, I think we probably don't, and I think there are some huge decisions around, you know, I think people always talk about the orchestras and all the infrastructure of the BBC as low-hanging fruit in terms of do we need all of that, but he will have to make some big decisions. I think he needs some sort of big paradigm shift thinking. This is the moment for an absolute fresh look. I think the status quo We cannot underestimate how fast it is going to be washed away. All of us in the studio are friends of the BBC. Indeed, they pay for our livings in various ways. I don't think we've got long where this kind of thinking will be the predominant thinking. I think the other thing to say is, as well, is the PR war that's raging around it. I think the culture wars are exhausting and tedious and going nowhere.
Which Tim Davie found, didn't he, in his time, and found himself increasingly consumed by. Just a final thought, because you've worked with him, Peter Barron. Is he the man then to do what you're both suggesting he needs to
do? Well, I think he has the great advantage that he's got fresh eyes and he can analyse the problems very quickly. And I also think, you know, tech companies and people from the tech world are very good at prioritising things, switching things off when they're not working, moving on to the future. So I think that future focus is certainly something he brings to the table.
Ash Atala and Peter Barron as well. Thank you both very much.
Thank you.
Thank you.
19 minutes to nine now. A review of the HS2 railway project set to be published this week is expected to say that political pressure and the original focus on achieving the highest possible speeds were among the reasons for the failings and for the ballooning costs as well. It's a report by the former National Security Advisor, Sir Stephen Lovegrove. It's due to be published tomorrow. Ruth Cadbury is a Labour MP and chair of the Transport Select Committee. Good morning.
Good morning.
I know that you've had some sight of this. I don't know how much, but I know that you've been looking at HS2 from the very start. Does this chime with what you already know?
Absolutely. I've only seen what's in the Times, but we know that the Secretary of State, Heidi Alexandri, is making a statement tomorrow. And in fact, the Rail Minister and the Chief Exec of HS2 are coming to our committee on Wednesday morning. But the conclusions that I can see in this article chime with what ourselves and the Public Accounts Committee have been hearing for two or three years now, the reset is overdue, but is going to take a bit longer than we had originally expected.
And when we look at the finer details of this, I talked there about political pressures and focus on achieving the highest possible, not just high speeds, but the highest possible speeds. What problems did those things cause in practice?
Well, the whole problem was not just the speed, but also that spades were in the ground before the project had been fully designed and permits granted and so on. And it broke the mantra of major projects, which is, plan slow and build fast. And from the word go, there was such an urgency from politicians of the time to get on with it that the project hadn't been fully specced and all the risks associated with it worked out. And also that there was political interference down the line as well, such as seeking tunnels instead of cut and cover and other problems as well. So the speed isn't the only problem with this project.
No, and the speed under the new plans, I think the speed will be reduced from what the plans were. Is that correct?
That's right. I think from about 360 kilometres per hour to about 300, which still brings HS2 into the similar ballpark as the TGV in France and the Shinkansen in Japan. But the most important thing about HS2 from the beginning for so many people and so many communities in the north of England is to link, to create new capacity that is so desperately needed between London and the north of England and eventually to Scotland.
More detail to come on that story in the next few days. Ruth Cadbury, thank you for joining us, Chair of the Transport Select Committee.
16 minutes to nine is the time. The whole of the world of rugby union is mourning the death of Scott Hastings. He was only 61. He had been suffering from non-Hodgkin's lymphoma. Scott Hastings capped a score for Scotland many, many times, 65 times in all, but also he toured twice with the British and Irish Lions. He was also universally liked and admired. And Kenny Logan is on the line, himself, of course, former Scottish international player. Good morning to you, Kenny.
Morning.
So sad. And it is right to say, isn't it, this is going to be felt not just in the world of rugby union, but much more widely as well.
Yeah, I mean, I've had messages this morning from Tim Horn in Australia. Can't believe it. Scott was working during the Six Nations. And, everybody's in shock of it. And we knew that The cancer had come back. He was getting treatment, but to get the shock of yesterday, you know, somebody who lived life for every day. He had such spirit about him. You know, he helped people. He was constantly, if you ever asked him to do something, it was always a yes. Great individual. And it's been a hard time the last couple of years. Sadly, passing of Jenny, his wife, and you know, this to happen yesterday was just a real shock to everybody. And true legend.
And also, I mean, you mentioned the work that he does outside rugby and the charity work that he did, in spite of being ill himself, and he'd been working, hadn't he, with Doddy Weir's charity and others as well.
Yeah, he was, as I said, I think he was a very successful commentator with ITV and other channels, and I think certainly for My Name Is Doddy Foundation, he was there from the start, and he was then chairman of the foundation, stepped down 2 or 3 years ago, but still an ambassador. As you say, he was still working for many charities and thinking about other people rather than himself sometimes. And yeah, he'll be sadly missed because he was a ball of energy. And, you know, I got my first cap for Scotland when Scott was in the team. And I remember him with the excitement for you getting capped. And I'll never forget how enthusiastic he was and how much he just wanted you to do well all the time, everything you did. So he's very positive too, individual.
And he was a doughty fighter, wasn't he, for Scotland, but also a really doughty fighter for the Lions and someone who meshed in with other players. You think of him playing alongside Jeremy Guscott back in the day.
Yeah, I mean, Scott was his big thing was his strong running and he could tackle. His tackling was incredible and he was quick. And I think, you know, when he played for the Lions, he was young, and you know, him and Jerry Guscott became a great partnership, and the flair of Jerry and the hard work that Scott did. But he's not just a Scottish rugby player; he's an iconic, an iconic family. In fact, you know, Adam Hastings, Gavin Hastings, you know, a lot of history in rugby and with that family. And it's not, as you say, it's across the world, rugby community are mourning this morning.
Do you, when you look back on him, it's funny, I was looking at clips of him playing earlier on today. There's something about the modern game, and you'd say he was a fearsome tackler. He was an extraordinary tackler, wasn't he? But back in a day when, I mean, most of the players were not as large as they are now, most of the hits were not as great, but in a sense he was showing the way, wasn't he, actually, for something that without malice, but with enormous force, would be the future of the game.
Yeah, I mean, Scott was a big lad anyway, and even back in the day he wasn't the sort of person you'd want to tackle much because he was really fierce and direct at you. And if you weren't on your game, he made you look stupid. So Scott was definitely in front of the game. His defence was something that, if you look at the game now, defence is so important. But Scott, you know, and also when he was in 1990 Grand Slam, that was one of his famous tackles, which he caught Jerry Guscott from behind. And that was one that probably was a try-saving tackle. So there's moments of Scott just using his pace, and his defence was just one of the key strengths of his game.
Yeah, English supporters of a certain age will certainly remember that tackle, and we'll remember with great affection Scott Hastings, who's died at the age of 61. Kenny Logan, thank you.
It's 11 minutes to 9 now. 5 years after their last hit series, It's a Sin, Russell T Davis and their director Peter Hoare have teamed up again for a new one. It's called Tiptoe. Stars Alan Cumming and David Morrissey, and it follows two next-door neighbours in a Manchester suburb. One is the owner of a bar in Manchester's gay village. The other is an electrician wary of his neighbour, and it's a dark thriller that follows their struggles to try and live peacefully side by side. Here's a bit of it.
I've locked myself out. I was just putting something in the bin and then... click.
So, what you want, a ladder?
No, I don't think I've got any windows open. I just need to phone my friend Stephanie. Remember her, my best mate? She's got a spare key. I mean, I've got a spare key, but guess what it is? In the house. Fat lot of good that is.
Yeah, look, you better get in, haven't you?
I'm Russell T Davies, the writer, producer, creator of Tiptoe, joins us. Good morning.
Hello, good morning. Aye.
You've always been, in your writing, influenced by what you see in the world around you. And is this more of that?
It absolutely is. I was driven to write this. I'm very proud and happy and lucky to have a kind of tradition of writing about certainly the lives of gay men over the past 26 years since Queer as Folk. And with this one, I literally had to run home and write it as fast as I could because of what I felt was happening in the world, a rising anger, a rising radicalization, a sliding backwards of gay rights. And that ended up with me pouring this onto the page, absolutely.
And I'm really conscious that I don't want to get into spoiler territory with this, so I don't want to talk too deeply about the storyline, but yeah. It's fair to say, I mean, I described it there as a dark thriller, but this really does take some of those issues that are happening in the world and you know, take them by the scruff of the neck and give them a shake.
It's tough. It's a hard piece of work. That's why I'm really glad to be writing for Channel 4. When I write at the BBC, they insist on me giving things happy endings in case it drives people away. It's true. And at Channel 4, you can kind of... I mean, it's what Channel 4 is for, is to kind of sit back and be a bit more radical and a bit more opinionated. And, this is a strong piece of work. I am duty-bound to say it's also a lot of fun. Alan Cumming is in there. It's got a wonderful supporting cast, a lot of young talent in there, but it certainly comes out swinging for the fences from scene one. Be warned, from scene one onwards, it gets tough.
You've talked as well about when you write characters, and in this case, you've got a character who in many ways mirrors your own life and your own story, but then somebody else who is completely different. So where do you go for that, to try and inhabit that kind of person who is so, so very different in life, but in opinion to you?
I think that's why I'm a writer. I mean, I think every writer could sit here. Agatha Christie could sit here and say, I write murderers. And I don't think she was a murderer. Although, that's a good drama. I'd write that one. But, you know, it's why we're writers in the first place, to explore what's going on. And I've got to say, the interesting thing about Tiptoe is that obviously it's me telling a story through a gay lens or a queer lens, but actually in a story about the war between two neighbours and the radicalisation of society, a Jew could have written this. If this was a Jewish version of the story, you wouldn't be calling it timely, you'd be calling it too late. We can see what's happening out there on the streets. If it was a disabled version of this story, I have a friend who's a wheelchair user who has had a complete stranger knock on the door and turn up on her doorstep to tell her that she's lying, that she's a benefit fraud, and that she can actually walk. That's actually physically happening in the world now. What we think of as an online rage, which for many years I thought was simply online voices being online, is now transferring into the real world, and that is what is terrifying. And that's actually what Tiptoe is about. It goes beyond gay, lesbian, bi, and it goes into this anger in the world.
I always think one of the great ways in which drama tells these stories as well is that you talk about the online world and how full of vitriol it is, how people argue, how people never really see a rounded individual. You know, it's all about big numbers and it's things at large scale. But actually, when you take two people, two men, two neighbours, and you round them out and you explore their stories and their motivations, that's a way, I think, to get through to people in a way that the online world often doesn't.
Oh, I hope so. I mean, that's why I tend to work in drama. But like I say, I think I have spent a long time debating with myself whether the online world is making people worse in their opinions, or is the online world revealing what we always actually thought, which is a lot more terrifying? Have we just been very polite for 60 years, the first 60 years of modern communications? And certainly, being online is a brand new form of communication that we did not evolve to suit. And we are taking it so lightly and so much enjoying its benefits at the same time that I think we're actually sliding into hell.
Which do you think it was always there? And it's just people's ability to say it without the judgment that they might have faced before?
I would love to know, and I will keep writing and keep trying to find that out. I mean, we also live in a world where I think, yes, there were people sitting at home with radical opinions that perhaps they didn't like to express. But when the president of America is tweeting or on his own Truth Social, literally swearing and advocating violence and reveling in the death of people, then those other people in society are being given tremendous permission to start saying what they always felt. So I wish I could see a way out of this, but I can't see it getting better.
Well, it's called Tiptoe, new drama. It's coming very soon from Russell T. Davis. Thank you so much for coming in and telling us about it.
Thank you.
It is just coming up to 4 minutes to nine. Jonathan Agnew, you think of that name, you think of Test match special, you think also that he won three Test caps for England. You think, in other words, cricket, not much more than cricket in a way, but more than 40 years since he was a music scholar at school. The commentator known as Agas has returned to music. He's taking up the euphonium, his new hobby, it transpires, one of the greatest joys in his life. He's now a dedicated member of his local brass band, the Melton Band, and he's on the line now. Morning, Jaggers. What?
I didn't think I'd be talking to you about this, I must say.
This is most peculiar. Just hearing your voice, actually, I feel we should be talking cricket, but we're not going to.
We will soon.
Tell us about how it started.
Well, look, I mean, I've always loved music. And like many, many people, I think the point of this is that many people learn music instruments at school. I'm sure you did of some sort. And then you get to leave school and you put it away. And often you don't go back to it again until you get to my sort of age now, where you're knocking around, the kids have left, and life changes. And many people in the band that I play with, and I know this is true of a lot of people, I mean, reading the sort of below the line comments of things, they go back. You go back to playing the musical instrument. And what's beautiful about it is that, A, you never lose that love of playing, especially in a brass band, that beautiful, evocative sound. But actually, the muscle memory of having played all those years ago is actually still there. I mean, I couldn't blow a note when I started, when they dumped a band euphonium off at my front door and said, there you go. But I can remember the notes, the valves, you know, the fingers that you press from 45 years ago. And it's just to go along and be part of a team, which is what you are, of course, in a band. But I would just encourage anybody who is thinking, oh, I've got that old cornet up in the loft. Get it out. Get it out and give it a blow and go and join a band. You'll have the friendliest welcome, I promise you.
Does the band want to talk about cricket?
No. Happily, they don't really. Well, if they do, they keep it quiet. No, I'm second euphonium. If I play a bum note, Tony tells me off. He's the man in charge. And on we go. That's how it should be, isn't it? You know, I just want to go and just be part of the band. And it's brilliant. They've given me such a lovely welcome.
And for you, what has it done? Because, you've expressed the joy about it, etc. Is there more to it than that? Does it root you in something that you began with? I mean, or is that overselling it?
It might be overselling. I mean, I think what it does, it gets you back into working again. I mean, like, practicing. You know, I think my day job these days is, you've got to work, and you sit there and your brain is working as you conjure up images and descriptions as you commentate on cricket. But actually to go away and to improve and get better, which you did as a professional cricketer, that's kind of drilled into you. And so to rediscover that and get across
really
and play a wrong note.
Remember talking to Condoleezza Rice when she was Secretary of State in the States. My name, well, I couldn't name drop as many famous people as you, Agnes, but my one is Condoleezza Rice, because she said exactly what you've just said, actually. The reason why she carried on practicing an instrument during the time that she was Secretary of State was that she wanted to do something that was difficult. So being Secretary of State, she didn't feel was particularly difficult.
Did she play the euphonium? Or?
I'm not sure it was the euphonium, actually. I think she's more of a pianist, but whatever. Right. Here we go. Look, you have kindly agreed, I think, to play us out with your euphonium. So I don't know what preparations you have to make.
Well, I'm under a lot of pressure.
You are
actually
under a lot
more
of pressure
because
yeah.
my computer screen's gone blank. But I mean, Sol Limbo, our tune, back again, is not a euphonium song. It's a great tune, and it's, you know, everyone knows Sol Limbo.
Oh, yes.
I did play in Pakistan a couple of times for the Barmy Army Jerusalem, which is kind of the Barmy Army's song, you know. So shall I have a go at that?
Here we go. Go for it. Right, okay. Jonathan Agnew on the euphonium. 1, 2, 3, go.
5 million people listening, just pressure.